Well, I would have said this court will allow prayer if it's a typical non-denominational prayer. The prayer can refer to God or the Almighty, but the prayer must not refer to Jesus. Make no mistake, the court's going to have a United States Marshal in attendance at the graduation, and any student that offends this court by mentioning Jesus in a prayer, that student will be summarily arrested and face 6 months incarceration. That's a federal judge saying, I'm going to have a United States Marshal at the graduation to arrest you if you mention Jesus in your prayer. Now, that's the court using the sword. So you're right. They couldn't do it. He was full of a lot of hot air, and it would be unconstitutional for the court to call in a United States Marshal. That is a violation of the separation of powers. But he's certainly threatening in that way. So he's trying to force the executive to use their police power in the way that they say. So I would say they still don't have the power, but you're right. They are, in some ways, using the sword by simply directing the other branch on how to do it. So here's what Giles says with regard to them being the weakest and their role with regard to the other two branches. And this is a little bit of a long quote, so stay with me, but put your seatbelt on. You're going to be shocked by some of the things he says. He says, superficial observers take it for granted that the three departments of the government are coordinate and independent of each other. It is to be observed that the words coordinate and independent are not to be found in any part of the Constitution. According to the Constitution, the establishment of the Judiciary Department was entrusted to the Legislative Department. Is the Judiciary Department formed by the Constitution? It is not. It is only declared that there shall be such a department, and it is directed to be formed by the two other departments who owe a responsibility to the people. So you got your executive, you got your legislative, and you got the judiciary. The Constitution sets up the executive and the legislative and tells you exactly how they're going to work. It sets up the judiciary only from the standpoint of saying, you guys create this department and you hold it accountable. Why? Because you owe a responsibility to the people. So you and me, we don't have a direct relationship with the court. We don't have any way to hold them accountable. But through the other two branches, we can hold them accountable. He said the number of judges, the affirmation of duties, the fixing of compensations, the fixing of the times when and the places where the court shall exercise their functions are left to the entire discretion of Congress. Congress may postpone the sessions of the courts for 8 or 10 years and establish others to whom they could transfer all the powers of the existing courts. The spirit as well as the words of the Constitution are completely satisfied provided one Supreme Court be established. Or in the more modern words of Congressman Steve King of Iowa, constitutionally, the Congress can reduce the judiciary to nothing more than Chief Justice John Roberts sitting at a card table with a candle. I love that picture. Constitutionally, the Congress can reduce the judiciary to nothing more than Chief Justice John Roberts sitting at a card table with a candle. The only constitutional requirement for the federal judiciary is that there's a Supreme Court, and then Congress decides how many members are going to sit on that court, and Congress decides how many and whether or not to have lower courts. So the only thing you have to do constitutionally, what Giles is saying, is have a Supreme Court. Everything else is up to the executive and the legislative branches together in determining how they're going to do it. Now, am I suggesting to only have a Supreme Court? Of course not. But it is within their power to reduce the number of courts at any time, to add new courts, to impeach judges, to get rid of courts. All of those things Congress has the power to do. Let's look at Article 3, page 28, right up at the top. Who gets to decide how many courts we're going to have? You remember me mentioning former Attorney General McCasey and him saying that it was the court that created the lower courts? No. It says that the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. Entirely up to Congress how many appellate courts we have, whether or not we have appellate courts, whether or not we are going to have a lot of district courts, how all of that's going to work, Congress makes that decision. And then we find out that these guys also, meaning Congress and the President, set the agenda for the court. Do you know that Congress can take an issue away from the courts? Congress can say right now, they can pass a law right now that says Ten Commandments cases, under God and the pledge, no longer something we need the court to decide on. We're telling you it's constitutional, and we're going to say that the courts can no longer even hear those cases. They can't even tell the people that that's unconstitutional. So what it says right there, it says, shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. That's why very often you see the Congress pass a law and they have a little clause in there that says not reviewable by the courts. It's usually some, you know, local issue or not a big issue, and so nobody makes a big deal out of it. We've actually passed in the House twice legislation taking the under God out of the pledge and the Ten Commandments cases away from the courts. We just can't get it through the Senate. So we haven't been able to accomplish that constitutional responsibility of Congress in taking an issue away from the court. But we've gotten close. The power is there. We should use it. So are they equal? No, they're not equal. The legislative is the strongest. The court is to be the weakest. And the executive is right in the middle. And in fact, I like how Thomas Jefferson put it. He said, if the court, think about your three equal branches and the court being the weakest. He said, if the court ever becomes equal to the other two branches, meaning it's weaker, we don't ever want it to rise to the level of being equal. He said, if it ever becomes equal to the other two branches, it will have the final say on every law in America, and we will be ruled by the despotism of an oligarchy. That's what we've got right now. We let the court raise itself up to being equal to the other two branches, and the result of that is now it is more powerful than the other two branches because it has the final say on every law in America. So we have presidents saying, I'm going to sign this law even though I think it's unconstitutional. We'll have to wait and see what the court says. We have Congress backing off and letting the court have the final say on everything in America. It's not how they intended it. The court was supposed to be the weakest branch. Its job was simply to apply the Constitution to specific circumstances and in rare cases rule a law unconstitutional. And we'll talk about what can happen after that if the court does rule a law unconstitutional. But let's go to an easy one first. Myth number two. Federal judges are appointed for lifetime appointments. True or false? How long are they appointed for? Who said good behavior? Go ahead and get the book. You already have Founders Fables, don't you? Well, now you get one to give away as a Christmas present. Good behavior. So what does good behavior mean? What judge is that? You know what good behavior today means? Does he have a pulse? Got a pulse. Okay, he's alive. We're going to leave him on the bench. That's not what the founders intended. Good behavior is something very different than that. In fact, let's find out what they meant by good behavior. If they're only appointed for good behavior, what did the founders mean? Or actually, pretty close to the founders, the Judiciary Act of 1801 and 1802, John Calhoun, he said, as the author of the Judiciary Bill, we all fully and at once understand what is good behavior in a judge. And if he acts contrary, it would be misbehavior. And the Constitution in that case is given a remedy by impeachment. That's exactly right. So, impeachment. Do we ever use this tool? I mean, it hasn't been used at all. I mean, we have six clauses in the Constitution talking about and mentioning impeachment. We have used it quite a bit, actually. 63 impeachment investigations, 17 actual actual convictions on impeachment. So 63 times we've said, you did something wrong, we're going to have a hearing, and we found 17 times it was bad enough to remove them from office. The last time, three times ago, was this guy right here, Alcee Hastings. Anybody remember that name? Florida federal judge was found to be taking bribes, and so he was impeached by the Congress and removed from office, and the people of Florida said, wow, taking bribes, removed from office, that qualifies him for Congress. And so they elected him to Congress, and he became a member of Congress. Now, interestingly enough, let's take a look at how impeachment works real quick. Flip back to Article 1, because the Congress is the one that does impeachment, right? So let's take a look at, let's take a look at impeachment in Article 1, Section 5 and 6, page 10. Actually, let's do the House first. Both chambers have responsibility in impeachment, and they're different. The House is like the grand jury. If the prosecutor says that they think you're guilty of a crime, they go to the grand jury and they present the worst case scenario on you. You don't really get a chance to respond. The grand jury says, if everything the prosecutor's saying is true, this person needs to go on trial. So they hand down an indictment based on all the worst case scenario. Then you go to trial, and the regular jury gets to hear not only the prosecutor's worst case scenario, but your defense as well, and the jury decides, are you guilty or innocent? So indictment and then a decision of guilt or innocence. Impeachment works the same way. The House is the grand jury, and they decide, okay, if everything we're being told is true, this person needs to be impeached. And then it goes over to the Senate, and they're like the regular jury, and they have the trial, and they decide based on all the worst case stuff and your defense whether you get convicted. So look at Article 1, Section 3 on page 8. We find that the Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. And just below that, we find out judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. So how did Alcee Hastings get impeached as a federal judge and then get to serve in Congress? I guess Congress is not an office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States, right? No, I'm kidding. We shouldn't be that cynical. It is, of course, or should be. Unfortunately, when you get impeached, the Senate has a choice. They can do two things. They can remove you from office and or bar you from ever running for office again at that level. And they only chose to remove you from office, and they didn't give him the second punishment. Now, by the way, that doesn't mean you're totally off the hook. You know, if you have a judge that commits a murder, they don't get impeached and removed from office, and then they're okay. Now, the local DA, as it says right there at the end of that paragraph, but the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law. So local DA is going to go after him for the murder. But Congress is the one that removes him from the bench. In his case, they only gave him the first of the two punishments, and so he got to run for Congress. He was Nancy Pelosi's choice to head up the subcommittee on intelligence. You really want the guy taking bribes to be the one with all the secrets, right? So fortunately, everybody raised the stink, and she recanted and didn't give him that appointment. But the point is, we've done this before quite a bit, and there were several examples. People think of impeachment. In fact, it talks, you know, we hear that phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors. And we always think that means that it's got to be a big crime. It's got to be not a crime misdemeanor committed at a high level, meaning high office, but that it's got to be a major bribe. It's got to be a major horrible crime for them to be impeached, not just the fact that they actually committed a misdemeanor or that they also did something that embarrassed the nation or that was a violation of their oath of office. In fact, let's get a couple of examples here. These are some of the things that we've impeached for in the past. Issued an order contradicting an act of Congress, drunkenness in private life, rudeness in the courtroom, profanity, judicial high-handedness. I mean, these were things we impeached for. So it wasn't just you took a bribe or killed somebody. Justice Marshall, he got real concerned about this idea that, you know, you could impeach a judge because they're handing down decisions that are unconstitutional or handing down decisions that contradict an act of Congress. He said, the present doctrine seems to be that a judge given a legal opinion contrary to the opinion of the legislature is liable to impeachment. A lot of members of Congress said yes. If a judge is going to start saying that you can't even have under God in the pledge, or as Newt has pointed out, that judge in San Antonio is going to prevent kids from being able to pray in public, that's somebody that is not fit for the federal bench. And we used to say it was okay to impeach them. In fact, Alexander Hamilton said why. Impeachment is a bridle in the hands of the legislature. Think about that word picture. Congress is pulling back on the bridle that's in the mouth of the court. We're reigning in the court, and Congress has a responsibility to do that. See, these folks that want equal branches or want the independence of the judiciary, they mean by independence of the judiciary, no accountability. They mean no checks and balance. You know what a truly independent judiciary means? They don't ever have to answer to anybody. They can do anything that they want. Do you want that? I don't want that. I want a balance of powers. I want checks and balances, and that means not independence like Sandra Day O'Connor's running around the country telling you that we want. We threw out those three judges in Iowa that had forced gay marriage on Iowa, won those elections in 2010. O'Connor was up there campaigning for those judges, saying, this is wrong. You can't hold these judges accountable for what they did. That violates the independence of the judiciary. I don't want an independent judiciary that doesn't have to answer in some way, shape, or form. Impeachment is one of those ways. I think he says constitutional arms. Yeah, each branch is furnished with constitutional arms for its own effectual powers of self-defense. I mentioned earlier that if you have one branch encroaching upon the branch on another branch, the branch being encroached upon has got to push back. Impeachment is one of the ways that Congress can push back. James Iredell was an original Supreme Court Justice. He said, every government requires impeachment. Every man ought to be accountable for his conduct. Impeachment will not only be the means of punishing misconduct, but it will prevent misconduct. A man in public office who knows that there is no tribunal to punish him may be ready to deviate from his duty. That's where these judges are right now. They think there's nobody going to hold me accountable. If I'm not thinking I want to get an appointment to a higher court, they think they have no accountability ever. The only reason they stay in line at all is because they're hoping to get appointed to something higher later down the road. He said, but if he knows there's a tribunal for that purpose, although he may be a man of no principle, the very terror of punishment will perhaps deter him. Impeachment is that terror of punishment, that accountability. We don't use it enough. We should. They are not appointed for life. They're appointed for good behavior. And the best way to remind the judiciary and the American people of that is have more of these impeachments. I actually strongly support for 10 years. I've been talking about it, and Governor Perry picked up on it in his book, Fed Up. I hope more people will talk about it. I would love to see a constitutional amendment that defines the term of a federal judge. So it's no longer good behavior, some nebulous deal, but it's 10 years or it's 15 years or 20 years. I don't even care how long it is, but that there's a specific amount of time and there's a day of accountability. at the end of that term if they want to get appointed again. So they don't hold lifetime appointments. It's good behavior, but we've got to use impeachment if we want to enforce that. Myth number three, primary responsibility of the judiciary is to protect the minority from the majority. Some people actually think that the Bill of Rights and the freedoms that we're talking about today in the Constitution are only for the minority. They're not for the majority, that they're only applied to the minority. In fact, this is the Supreme Court. The purpose of the Bill of Rights is to protect the minority from the majority. I was kind of thinking that Second Amendment was for me, too. I was kind of thinking it was for you. You know, sometimes I'm in the minority, sometimes I'm in the majority. When I go to, you know, up north and to the northeast, I'm a country bumpkin, man. I'm in the minority, believe me. But it doesn't matter if I'm the minority or majority. My civil rights and my constitutional rights shouldn't change based on whether I'm in the minority or the majority. The Bill of Rights is for all of us. But this mentality that has taken over the court and a lot of the country is that we're going to use the law to take the minority point of view and force it on the majority because somehow they don't have the ability to get out their message or what they believe. We see it in the reflection of all of these court cases over the last 30 or 40 years. Now, something these guys agreed on. I mean, here you got a Federalist and an Anti-Federalist, Washington and Jefferson. Totally different political parties later on and essentially philosophies of how this ought to work. But something they all agreed on and said the exact same thing. The fundamental principle of our Constitution requires that the will of the majority shall prevail. You're not always going to have the most popular opinion or position, and part of that, you got to respect the fact that the majority rules. But today, think about the anti-majoritarianism in our country today. Think of all the court decisions that are handed down as a way of saying 90% of the country may want this, but we're going to side with the 10% or the 5% or the 1%, and we're going to force that view on everybody else. We'll just run through a litany of them. How about gay marriage? 72% don't want it, but the courts force it on us. You got prayer in school. 82% want prayer in school. The courts say you can't have it. We're going to side with the minority. Teaching intelligent design. 68% say you ought to teach both. You ought to teach some form of both theories. Only 32% say only evolution, and yet the courts side with the minority and force that view on everybody else. 70% of the country wants some sort of restrictions on abortion. Courts constantly ruling against that. Ten Commandments in classrooms, 76% say we ought to have the Ten Commandments in the schools. Court sides with the minority over the majority. Pledge of Allegiance, 90% say we ought to have the pledge being recited and keep under God in there, yet the court rules against that sort of thing. It's all part of this mentality that our job is to protect the minority. And so the heckler's veto, one person, their opinion or position becomes more powerful than the 99, more powerful than everybody else. That is not a constitutional American concept. It's exactly the opposite. And it all comes back to this belief that the Bill of Rights and the role of the courts is only to protect the minority. It should be equal protection under the law, like you were talking about. It should be making sure that all of us have our rights protected and we don't infringe upon the others. Myth number four, only judges are capable of determining constitutionality and their primary responsibility is judicial review. Court says we're the final arbiter of the court, of the law. The court functions as guardian and interpreter of the Constitution. The perception being that the courts and Congress and the president, they don't know the Constitution. They don't understand the Constitution. We high priests of the law, we on the Supreme Court, we in the teaching in the law schools, we're the only ones that understand the Constitution and the law, and therefore we will protect it from those representatives of the people. Even the Encarta Encyclopedia, the Supreme Court's principal power is judicial review, the right of the court to declare laws unconstitutional. Well, let's see what the guys that gave us the Constitution say about whether or not the court's the only one that can do that. James Madison. The argument is that the legislature itself has no right to expound the Constitution, that whenever its meaning is doubtful, you must leave it to take its course until the judiciary is called upon. That's what Bush did when he signed McCain-Feingold to declare its meaning. I beg to know upon what principle it can be contended that any one department draws from the Constitution greater powers than another in marking out constitutionality. You got executive, legislative, judiciary. He's saying, you show me where one of the three has more power than the other two in terms of determining constitutionality. Each one of us has a voice in determining this. Nothing has yet been offered to invalidate the doctrine that the meaning of the Constitution may as well be ascertained by the legislative as well as by the judicial authority. Saying we in Congress have just as much voice as to say whether or not something is constitutional or not constitutional. Elbridge Gerry, signer of the Declaration and Vice President, said it is quite foreign from the nature of the judiciary's office to make them judges of the policy of public measures. Now, let's do that. Let's break that down, because I love this. He's saying it's foreign. It's not natural for the court to decide policy issues, public policy issues. What's a public policy issue? Abortion? Marriage? Tax issues? Most of the issues the court is deciding today, he's saying, why are we giving these decisions to a judiciary that's unelected? Their job is only to take the public policy position of the nation and apply it to a fact circumstance, not to write the law. In fact, what's the first part? Let's flip to the first page of the Constitution. Very first page. Who's supposed to make the law? All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in the Congress. That means lawmaking. So who's supposed to make the law? Article 1, the Congress. Not Article 3, the courts. Thomas Jefferson, the opinion which gives to the judges the right to decide what laws are constitutional and what not, would make the judiciary a despotic branch. The Constitution, on this hypothesis, is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please. And that's what they've been doing. For the last 40 or 50 years, we've empowered the court to say, you're it. You're the end-all, be-all. You can decide every policy in the country. Nothing counts until the court says that it's okay. That is not how the founders intended it. Alexander Hamilton, the legislative department is more immediately the confidential guardian of the people's rights and liberties. Why is that? Why would the legislature be more immediately the guardian or the confidential guardian of the people's rights? They're closer to us, right? Like we said, we don't really have a relationship with those federal judges. We don't have a way to personally pull them in. But we can pull in the legislative department. We can make them answer and respond. It may take a couple of years, 3 or 4 years, to turn a Congress around and get them back on the right track. But ultimately, they are going to answer to us and change, and the court does not. And that's why he's saying the legislative department responds more quickly. That's why when you look at any issue, a lot of people say, well, yeah, but wasn't it the courts that brought about civil rights? Wasn't it the courts that protects all these other individual rights that Congress... Look, you watch David Barton's video on American history in black and white, and he documents for you how Congress got it right long before the courts did. We had great civil rights laws in the 1860s and 1870s fixing all the problems. And then the court started striking down these laws and allowing the discrimination to continue to take place in the South, and then you end up with all the Jim Crow laws and the white-only primaries and all the things that happened. And then finally, after the court had messed it up and stopped it, Dred Scott's another perfect example. The Supreme Court says no black man has any right that any white man has to recognize. That's the court coming in and forcing that on the American people. The legislature and the people got it right and reversed the court. Same thing in civil rights. Later on, we finally reversed what the court did, and then the court starts handing down decisions, and everybody says, oh, the court's fixing things. The court was finally coming around to what the people had fixed 80 years before and fixing their own position. The point is, the court is always going to be way behind in terms of catching up with where the people are. And that's why, Elbridge Gerry said, it's foreign for the court to decide these policy issues. But today we're letting them decide all of that because we bought this idea that they're the only ones can determine constitutionality. Now, that all brings us to a head, and you might say, okay, Rick, well, how's it supposed to work then? I mean, what happens if Congress passes a law, the president signs the law, and the court says it's unconstitutional, but the American people are saying, that's crazy. Maybe it's having under God in the pledge. What Alexander Hamilton said in the Federalist Papers is that when that happens, the Congress and the president can turn around and repass the law and say, thank you, court. We appreciate your opinion. Thank you for weighing in. We understand where you're coming from. Maybe we'll tweak it a little bit to fit this one part of your opinion, or maybe we're just going to ignore you completely. But we're saying it's constitutional regardless of what you're saying. You can do that. In fact, Rick Santorum did that with partial birth abortion. Passed partial birth abortion. Court ruled it unconstitutional. Came back later, passed it again. And this time the court didn't rule it unconstitutional. So, I mean, had they ruled it again unconstitutional, I think we would have come back and passed again. You just keep going back and forth. But absolutely, positively, the other two branches should have a voice in that and not just roll over every time the Supreme Court says that something's, quote, unconstitutional. But the only way that's going to happen is if we elect people to Congress and to the president that understand that. When Newt Gingrich stood up 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, whenever it was, and talked about this and said, We can rein in the court. We can fire judges. We can impeach and abolish courts. We can create new courts. We can pass a law in Congress that the court has ruled unconstitutional. We can pass it again and make it the law of the land. When he said all that, man, people went crazy. The media went nuts. Even conservatives like George Will and others said, Newt's wrong. You can't do that. They're wrong. Let me tell you, Newt is 110% correct. Go to newt.org and read his paper, his white paper, on this issue. It's 54 pages long, and it is spot on, 110% correct. He understands the history and the constitutional perspective on this. We need to be doing this. It's the biggest thing we can do to get the Constitution back in its proper place by putting the court back in its proper place. It's not going to happen unless Congress and the President stand up and do that. Congress and the President will only do that if we, the people, know that they can, and we ask them to do it, and we continually push for them to do it. You might remember in the Terry Schiavo case, when Tom DeLay stood up and said, we need to impeach some of these judges, the media went crazy and said the Congress is trying to take power from the courts. No, the Congress was trying to do what the Congress is supposed to do, rein in the courts, be the bridle, put the bridle back into the court so that the legislature can hold them in place. So the tools are there. The system works the way that Hamilton said would cause the court to not be a threat to our liberty. But we've got to get the system again working that way instead of being distorted the way that that it has been. So four myths. Number one, they are not three equal branches. Absolutely. Which branch is the most powerful? Legislative. Which one's the weakest? Judiciary, supposed to be the judiciary, and that's where we need to get them back to. They are not appointed for life. How long are they appointed for? Good behavior, that's it. We need to impeach more of them. In fact, you hang a few bloody scalps on the gallery rail and they'll get in line. Primary responsibility is to protect the minority from the majority. Is the Bill of Rights for the majority or the minority? Both. It's for both of them. It's for all of us. Only judges are capable of determining constitutionality. No, all three branches have the opportunity to determine constitutionality and weigh in on questions of constitutionality. Bottom line is, all three branches ultimately are responsible to us. These guys all said the same thing. All power residing originally in the people and being derived from them. So all power comes from us. God gives freedom to us, and then we give it to government. All that power that comes from us to them, the several magistrates and officers of the government vested with authority, whether legislative, executive, or judicial. So all three branches, they are our substitutes and agents and at all times accountable to us. So judiciary is accountable to us through the other two branches, and the other two branches are accountable directly to us. They only have that power because we've loaned it to them. James Wilson, he said, here the people are masters of government. Elsewhere, the government is master of the people. So they work for us, not the other way around. Yes, sir. I would. I would say there's two major roles for the Supreme Court. Advisory, in terms of is a law constitutional or unconstitutional, and application of a law. So a fact circumstance doesn't fit perfectly within application, and so you have to have somebody decide whether or not how to apply that law to that particular circumstance. And that's most of what the court deals with is, you know, here's the lawsuit between two people saying there's two different interpretations of how the law ought to be applied. So their job is to apply the law written by the Congress to specific circumstances, and in rare cases, advise the Congress that a law is unconstitutional. And I think even when you read the Federalist Papers, you see that they're only talking about rare cases where you're going to say something's unconstitutional. It's got to be on its face. I mean, it's got to be obvious that Congress has gone outside its power and outside its authority. I'm not saying the court should never rule along. I think they should do it more often when Congress gets outside its power. I'm just saying it's not the final say. And that once they do it, Congress can absolutely overrule that by coming back and passing the law again. And what it does is it creates the great debate in the public square, and then we the people can have the ultimate decision. Because you think about it, if Congress passes a law that the court rules unconstitutional, and we the people also think it's unconstitutional, Obamacare is a good example. I mean, what happens if the court says Obamacare is unconstitutional? You might say, well, Rick, aren't you saying then that if the court rules it unconstitutional, Congress should come back and pass it again? Yeah, I am. You think they would? No way. Not in this environment. Why? Because the great debate has awakened the American people, and we the people are saying it's an unconstitutional. There is no way Obamacare would pass Congress again right now. No way. I mean, you've got a House that's already said we want to repeal it. You've got a Senate that couldn't pass it again, and I believe after this election we'll actually repeal it. And so the system has worked. It's taken time, right? I mean, we're 3 years later. But it's taking time, but the system is working. But that's how, you know, that's if they did say it was unconstitutional and Congress wanted to do it again. I think the court will say it's unconstitutional and Congress won't do it again. I think we'll win on both fronts. But yes, you got it right. I think they're in an advisory position. It's stronger than that. I don't know the right language to say. It's more than advisory. I mean, it has some teeth to it. It should put a stop to that law, but it's not the end of the process. In other words, I think they should have the power to put a stay on a law But then that doesn't mean Congress has to just roll over and say, well, the five of the nine geniuses have ruled, which is kind of, that's how we look at it, right? We're waiting for those nine geniuses to rule. Once they decide, then we'll know whether or not we can do this or can't do that. That's not what the founders intended at all. Okay, so that's we can spend all day on the courts, and please, we'll talk about them all you want. Let's throw out a couple of more areas. I'm going to try to save our last. What time are we supposed to end, Pastor? 10 o'clock? Okay, no. 4:30. Okay, I'm going to do my best to save the last 30 minutes at least for just any questions you guys want to go towards. Article 4, we're not going to spend time on. Let's talk about amendments, okay? Because I know there's several amendments you might be for and would like to see happen. So before we get into amendments that are being proposed out there and gaining steam across the country, let's look at the amendment process itself. Two ways you can amend the United States Constitution. The first way is the only way that's actually been used. All 27 amendments have been used, adopted in Congress. So it's a two-step process. Congress has to adopt by two-thirds. And then it goes to the states, and it could go one of two directions. The states could do it by the state legislatures, or they could have state constitutional conventions like they did with the original Constitution. That's never been done. It's always been done right here. This method right here. So it gets adopted in Congress by two-thirds. And then it comes home to the states, and three-fourths have to ratify. So we got 50 states, so how many states have to ratify for an amendment right now with our current 50-state population to get it into the Constitution? 38. There you go. 38. 37 and a half, so you got to have 38. So 38 states have to ratify before an amendment gets into the Constitution. There's your normal method. Second method that could be done constitutionally, according to Article 5, is an amendment proposed at a national constitutional convention, and then you could go to either of those routes again, either to the legislatures or to state constitutional conventions. So what we call a con-con constitutional convention would be a place where amendments could be offered up, and if adopted at the constitutional convention, go back to the states for ratification. This has not been done. There are some out there proposing it. There are some that oppose it. So let's just have a little fun and debate here. How many of you would be in support of having a constitutional convention for new amendments to the Constitution? How many of you would be against having a constitutional convention for amendments to the Constitution? Give me some reasons why you'd be against it. Stand up and say it loud so we can hear you. Okay, anything could happen. It's dangerous because anything could happen. They could even get rid of the existing Constitution. How is that different from when Congress is meeting in Washington, D.C. right now? Hold that thought, because that's another issue. But just the issue of what could change in the Constitution. What's on the table? An amendment can come two ways, right? It can either come through Congress or it can come through a constitutional convention. And so if the concern is that at a constitutional convention, anything could be amended in the Constitution, how is that different from the first way to amend the Constitution? Right now in Congress, anything could be put on the table as an amendment. Oh, balanced budget amendment. Okay, but I guess what I'm asking is, how is a constitutional convention, in terms of it could be any issue, how is a constitutional convention any more dangerous than Congress? Okay, so the Congress is still responsible to us. That's a good point. So they answered us, these delegates, we don't know who they are, and they may go home and not care. No, a constitutional amendment doesn't have to go to the executive branch. Mm-mm. Just adopted by Congress and then goes to the states. There have been times, Lincoln was the first one to do it. He did actually sign the 13th Amendment, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments just as a show of support. But it doesn't have to go to the executive branch. It goes straight to the states. But everything's open to amendment and change in Congress, too. I mean, you could file any constitutional amendment in Congress right now, no different than at that constitutional convention, and anything's on the table. Okay, so that's a good point. At a constitutional convention, you could do 10 different amendments instead of just one. That's true? Yeah. That's a great place to go. Let's turn to Article 5 real quick. Okay. So what is a constitutional convention? And I'll tell you, there's not many people that know what a constitutional convention is because we hadn't done one yet. And it's not real descriptive. So it is pretty wide open. This is actually my biggest fear of a constitutional convention is it's not well defined. So let's take a look. Article 5, page 32. The Congress, whenever 2/3 of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or on the application of the legislatures of 2/3 of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments. So all we know is that if 2/3 of the states ask for a constitutional convention, so 2/3 is 34, right? Yeah, 34. If 34 states ask for a constitutional convention, then Congress calls for the convention, and each state will decide how they want to do their delegates. You can do them like you do your electoral college delegates. So each state will get to decide how many they want to send, but their voting block will be the same. Their strength will be the same regardless. So everybody will decide. They'll send their delegates. They'll say we hosted in Austin, Texas would be a good place. So we hosted a constitutional convention in Austin, Texas, and everybody sends their delegates in. Now, that constitutional convention is like Congress in that anything's on the table. One of the big debates on a constitutional convention is can you limit the call is the phrase you hear a lot. A lot of states have asked for a constitutional convention specific to a balanced budget, specific to the Equal Rights Amendment or whatever it might be. A lot of debate in this. Supreme Court would probably have to rule on it. Most scholars say, no, you can't limit the call. All you can do is call for the convention, and then at that convention, any amendment can be brought up. And so that's where the biggest fear comes in. Well, what if they get rid of the Second Amendment? What if they take out the whole Constitution and totally replace it? Well, what if they do that? What happens next? Still got to take it back to the states. So no matter what they do at that constitutional convention, it doesn't mean diddly squat until 38 states put their stamp of approval on it and ratify it. So all you need is how many states to kill a bad amendment? 13. 13 states can kill a bad one. It takes 38 to pass a good one. So I would argue that the constitutional convention in and of itself is not dangerous. I mean, it's probably less dangerous than Congress. A whole lot less dangerous than Congress. And right now, with the political momentum in the country being on the side of the Tea Party and the conservatives, I think that convention would be dominated by people that think like us, people that are in the movement right now to rein the federal government in. So I think your odds of good stuff coming out of that convention are far greater than anything bad coming out of it. And so then you got to say, okay, what's worst case scenario? What if Rick's wrong? What if some really bad stuff comes out of that convention, which is entirely possible? Then you just need 13 states to kill the bad amendments. And let's say that constitutional convention comes out and says, we're getting rid of the Second Amendment. I can rattle off 13 states that'll kill that amendment overnight. All right. There's no question in my mind we can kill that amendment. We may be 50-50 in terms of population in the conservative liberal fight in our country right now, but in terms of states, it's more like 35-15. We've got the massive majority in terms of states. So we have a huge, huge advantage when it comes to that safety valve right there of killing those bad amendments. All we need is 13 states to kill those bad amendments. So I am the only one in the room, I know, but I for one would say that the risk of a bad amendment coming out of the convention is actually very low when you look at the process and what would happen. And the reward of some good amendments coming through that convention and actually getting adopted, where we can't get them through Congress, but we could get them through a constitutional convention, is actually very high. So I, for one, I know I'm the only one in the room, am for a constitutional convention. I used to be very much against it for all the reasons that you're citing, but at the last few years as I've looked into this and studied it, I've become an advocate for it. I think it would be great. But for those of you that are very concerned now, let me just tell you, it ain't going to happen. Because I am in a small minority that wants it. Lots of conservatives and liberals both are against it, and it's just not going to happen. Think about if it did. Best civics lesson this nation has ever had. Because every night on the news, what are they going to be talking about? The Constitution. They're going to be talking about clauses in this Constitution people never even heard of. They're going to be talking about amendments that people are proposing. It would be phenomenal, even if not one single amendment actually made its way out of that convention and got ratified and put in the Constitution. It would be a wonderful, wonderful education for the American people. And so, if you think I'm by myself on this, I just want to tell you the names of a couple of people that are on my side. George Washington, William Samuel Johnson, William Livingston, Benjamin Franklin, James Wilson, Gouverneur Morris. In other words, why do you think they put it in there? They put it in there because they knew there would be a time when the American people needed to get around their Congress that the American people needed to take the bull by the horns and make some modifications to make the system once again become a more perfect union. My final say on this would simply be, never operate from a position of fear. Recognize that the system does work. Have some faith in the American people and in yourself, and let's go work to the system and use the tools that we've been given instead of shying away from those tools because of what could happen. Let's look at what's happening right now. Let's look at where we are right now and recognize that Congress could do any of these things you're worried about being bad things. They could do it right now. We, the people, have a much better chance of getting the good amendments if we had that constitutional convention. But it's not going to happen, so you guys win, I lose. Let's move on to how you could, what you would amend if you could get it through Congress right now if we don't have the constitutional convention. Ma'am, you were mentioning the balanced budget amendment, so we'll just start with that one. As we mentioned earlier, we lost it by one vote 13 years ago. I think that one probably has the best chance of any amendment we're going to talk about of getting passed in the next decade or so, and hopefully in the next 2 or 3 years. I've said for a while if we would take the Tea Party energy and focus it into two major changes, balanced budget amendment and term limits, we could see the biggest changes overall in terms of our system. Parental rights amendment, please write this down, parentalrights.org. Parentalrights.org. This is an amendment to the Constitution that is vital. How many of you heard of the UN Treaty on the Rights of the Child? Very, very bad treaty. Unfortunately, Somalia and America are the only ones, the United States are the only ones not to adopt it yet. It essentially puts your 10-year-old child in charge at your house. It empowers the state more to tell you how to raise your children, and it would violate not only our biblical worldview of the parental-child relationship, but most of our state laws. And here's the problem with that. Treaties trump your state laws. And so if this were to be adopted, if Congress ends up if the Senate ends up adopting the UN Treaty on the Rights of the Child, turn to page 34. This is Article 6, what we know as the Supremacy Clause. Second paragraph. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state, to the contrary, notwithstanding. Meaning, if the UN Treaty on the Rights of the Child is adopted by our Senate, which, believe me, Obama wants it, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton wants it, a lot of senators want it. Fortunately, we've got enough senators right now that we've been able to block it. But if it were adopted by the Senate and became a treaty that the United States was part of, it's now right there with the Constitution. It's part of the supreme law of the land, and it trumps state law. So even if your state law says, no, we're not going to empower a 10-year-old to make the decisions for the family, or no, we don't want our state to be able to step into the family situation on this decision or that decision. Doesn't matter. Your Oregon family law is now going to be trumped by the UN Treaty on the Rights of the Child. So it's a very, very dangerous, very, very bad deal. It's also why we constantly need to pay attention to those treaties, whether you're talking about, you know, Agenda 21 or you're talking about a lot of the other efforts out there for international law to step in and take over American law. Those treaties are a big, big deal. We tend to ignore them because we think that's, you know, just something we don't need to worry about. So get on the phone, burn up the phones every chance you get with your senators when these things come up. But parentalrights.org is something, it's something I support because it's an amendment that we need, not only for UN Treaty on the Rights of the Child. We spend all afternoon telling you horror stories of state CPS organizations abusing families and taking children away in homes where they're not being abused. I'm all for getting kids out of homes where they're literally being physically abused. But all over the country, we have empowered states to take kids out of situations where they're not being abused simply because the state disagrees with how the family's raising the child. And as a homeschool dad, as a Christian, as a patriot, everything I believe in puts me on the blacklist for most of these state organizations, you know, because I'm against abortion, because I'm all about the Constitution. You know, it's Janet Napolitano's domestic terrorist list. I'm like all over it because of all the things I believe in. It's the opposite of what they believe in. So there's just some areas that need to be codified in our Constitution for parents and the biblical worldview of how a parent-child relationship should work. So anyway, that's longer than I usually spend on that. I usually have the little cards to hand out, and I apologize, I'm out of them. But if you check out the website, parentalrights.org, you can learn more on how to help in your state to bring that amendment about. Human life amendment, not one that the founders would have thought you needed. They would have said this just is right there in the Declaration of Independence. I mean, life, liberty, and property. Life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. There's no question that we're supposed to protect the very purpose of government. In fact, when Reagan was explaining that this morning, if we go to the actual words of the Declaration, it says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. So the purpose of government, the whole reason we have government, is to secure these rights. What rights? So the purpose of government is to secure life, to protect your life. They would have never dreamed that we would find a sudden constitutional right to abortion, to take life. It's beyond beyond the imagination of the Founding Fathers. In fact, John Witherspoon said, here in America, we do not even allow parents to take the life of their child. But we do now. So anyway, Human Life Amendment, very important amendment to the Constitution. Marriage Amendment falls in the same vein in terms of the founders would have never thought you would have to define marriage. I would say, part of the reason for this, not even my own beliefs about marriage, is just from a legal perspective, the practicality of the mess that we're creating right now with some states having gay marriage and other states not having gay marriage and people moving between states and how do you apply? It's a mess. And the family law is going to be just in turmoil in another 10 years if we keep this up. So we need that amendment to get back to that basic bedrock principle of the founding unit in our culture. Term limits. Let's do another little debate here. For or against term limits. How many of you would be for term limits for Congress? How many of you would be against term limits for Congress? Come on, don't be chicken and don't be shy. I've been in state conventions for the Republican Party and the platform fighting against term limits. Tell me why you're against term limits. Yeah. Okay. Any other objections? Wait, let me repeat that real quick. He's saying everybody would be new basically, and you wouldn't have the institutional knowledge to run the business of government because everybody would be kind of learning on the job. Takes the decision away from the people. If your term limit is 10 years, then you have no control for the people. I'm not taking sides yet. I'm just repeating arguments. Chuck's asking, are we talking about all of them are rotating, meaning if you come out, you can go back in later? Interesting point. I've heard this. A form of term limits would be you can serve, say, 3 terms in a row, then you got to come out for a few years, and then you're allowed to go back in later. Is that what you're talking about? Oh, okay. Okay. No, I haven't heard that. I'm not sure. I haven't seen kind of how that would work. I mean, like the Senate works in terms of every 2 years, you got a third of the Senate up. With the House being only 2-year terms, I'm not sure how to implement that. I don't know. 4-year terms. That's an interesting point. I've lived that, man. In Texas, it's 2-year terms as well for state legislature, and it's very much that way. You're in office for basically 5 months, and then you're campaigning for a year and a half, and then you're in office for 5 months. So you're right about that. That does make it difficult, but I kind of like them having to campaign and come home and answer. All of these objections are the very reasons that I was against term limits for years. And then the smartest woman in the world got a hold of me. Not Hillary, my wife. And we actually, about 5 years ago, we're sitting down and she said, we've been in this for 15 years and we have lots of friends that we came into office with and are still in office. And she said, even the good folks are now becoming part of the problem because they've been there for 12 years, 15 years. They've lost the fire. They've started compromising too much and that sort of stuff. And they need to come home and live under the laws, and we need some new blood and all that. And so we started talking about it. And the more I looked at it and the more that I thought about it, I thought, my biggest objection in the past was what this gentleman back here raised, that the lobby will run the show. If you have term limits and the longest serving person there at the state level, let's say, was 6 years, or at the congressional level was 12 years, then the lobbyists are going to run everything, and they're going to say, well, you're gone in 5 years, so you better do what I say. And that was my biggest concern. The founders designed our system to be where the states could be the incubators of ideas, where they could try things and we could see if it worked. Washington, Florida, Oklahoma, several states have tried the term limits at the state level. And the fear of the lobby running the show has not at all happened. The opposite has happened. The legislators are going in and saying, I only got 6 years. I'm getting busy right now. I'm working on the things that I said I was going to come here and do. And I don't care what you say as a lobbyist. I'm moving forward. So it's actually had the opposite positive effect on that front. The institutional knowledge piece I also was concerned about. At this point, the institutional knowledge is what I want to get rid of. I want new blood. I want people coming in all the time that haven't been there, that can say, what? You've been doing this for how long? That doesn't make any sense. Back home in my business, I do it this way. And so that new blood and those new perspectives, I think, creates this chaos that's in the free market in government that always ends up with a better result than a controlled environment. Does. So that's my take on those different objections in terms of the taking the choice away from us. Would you be against the 22nd Amendment? In other words, would you rather presidents be able to run for unlimited terms? I don't know. I mean, if you're totally against term limits, you should also be against the president having term limits as well. I'm not absolutely passionate on this one way or the other. I totally understand the arguments against term limits, but I think we're at a juncture now where Congress has become just like FDR had become. And they've accumulated so much power to themselves. When 98% incumbency reelection happens, there's something wrong with the system. And the problem is they have too much power to use in the campaigns to get reelected. It's so hard to defeat incumbents. The good news is the American people have awakened, and we're beating guys in Republican primaries. We're taking out tons of incumbents because of this desire for new blood to get in there and fix it. And so maybe it will take care of itself. Maybe we'll do the term limits at the ballot box instead of having to do it in the Constitution. But me, for one, I would absolutely vote for term limits at this point and use that as a catalyst to radically shift this thing and get the ruling class out of Washington, D.C. and get a lot of new blood in there. Yes, sir. I can see how you feel that way. I might have felt that way when I first went into the legislature. But I found that there is no rocket science in government. And that the only area I would agree with that on is in national security. And that there are members of Congress that have been there, behind the scenes in those secret meetings that should be secret meetings, and the Constitution even allows for that, things to not be voted on and said on the floor of the House and put in the journal specifically for national security, that you need some of that. And I think that's why I'm always for at the congressional level, 12 years, not six, because I want some people there to be the mentors, if you will, that are bringing in the new blood and helping them to at least learn the system, but hopefully not pass. If it's too long, you get these 30-year folks, then they're past the point of putting the country first, and they've fallen into the I got to get reelected mode. So there's a part of me that agrees with a small part of what you're saying, but I have just not found, in my experience anyway, and I haven't served in Congress. I've only served at the state level in the legislature, but we work with an awful lot of congressmen and issues, and I've just never seen a single area of government that is so complicated or difficult to understand that there aren't citizens out there in business or private practice or whatever that couldn't do a better job than the folks that have been there for 15, 20, 30 years. That's just me. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I think that's why we do need this shift. Yeah. Well, it is, and in fact, that's what Reagan ran into. I mean, President Reagan, you know, he had his three big goals. He wanted to decrease the spending. He wanted to build the military back up and get the taxes down. And he was never able to decrease the spending because the entrenched bureaucracies, even when he could make the appointment at the top, you had these entrenched bureaucracies that were protecting at every level all of these constituencies of government. Handouts, basically. Not, and I don't mean just welfare. I'm talking in military and everything else. She asked, how do you change the zero-based accounting method? I know I'm always talking about Texas, but that's what we started doing in Texas 10 years ago. Twice in the last 10 years, Texas has had to deal with $10-plus billion deficits, and we did it without raising taxes. And we did it because of zero-based budgeting. So, you know, if I could be political for a moment, if you elect Rick Perry as president of the United States, he will push for that. I don't, at this point, think that's going to happen because of how poorly he did in the debates. But the mentality of what Texas did and has proven over the last 10 years, it really is the model. I mean, look, I'm I will brag on Texas for a minute. We have done in Texas what needs to be done. And you have to elect enough people to Congress and the president that those reforms happen. That's what we did in Texas. We spent 15 years working on the movement. And finally, in 2003, we took over the legislature. And I don't mean just Republican Party. I'm talking about a conservative mindset that first took over the party and then took over the legislature and brought in and got a chairman of appropriations that forced zero, coming back in and making them come back and start from scratch in that new year. And that can be done at the federal level, but it's going to take time. And I'll say this, in terms of getting this stuff done long term, what we're doing today, what Wall Builders does, we are the Air Force, okay? We drop the bombs. That's all we go around the country and we drop the information. We come in and we give you all we can in 24 hours and then we go back home. If you really want this to work, today has to be the beginning. And all these tables that are out here in the lobby, that's the Marines. That's the boots on the ground. These groups, these folks are doing the work that long term is going to solve the problem. Your 9-12 groups, the groups that you're doing locally, you got to get plugged into that. You got to have the ongoing sharpening each other's countenance and being able to come together and fight those battles locally and statewide and nationally. So if we're going to win any of this, it's not enough for us to just come together and get excited today and get a lot of information. All we're doing is giving you the bullets. These folks have the guns. Go out there and put the bullet in the gun and be able to go out and fight if you really want to save the nation. So, I just throw these amendments out there for you to consider. If the movement is there in the country, if there's enough momentum, then some of these things could be adopted. Last one I'll throw out there I mentioned earlier is defining the terms of federal judges. Now let's open it up. There might be some other ideas. I've had several good ideas out of these classes of amendments I hadn't even thought of that would be good. Somebody else been thinking about one or talked about one in your group? Okay, so an amendment that would limit how much you could put into a campaign. I would argue that the market should answer that question, and meaning the marketplace of ideas. If government decides how much you can put in, then government's going to somewhat limit who can run and control how much of a message can get out. Wait, I'm not explaining that very well. Take McCain-Feingold, for instance. The McCain-Feingold bill supposedly was going to get money out of politics and level the playing field so that everybody could be the same. What it did was it protected the incumbents because now they can campaign year-round, they can be on TV all the time, and if we want to criticize them in the last 60 days of the campaign, we're not allowed to criticize them. We don't get to go on television and criticize them. So it protected them instead of leveling the playing field or making it possible. Every time I ever ran for office, I found there are two campaigns. There's the campaign where you actually go out and win votes. But the first campaign is you've got to convince people of influence in your own family, in your own church, the people that can write the checks to help fund your campaign, the people that will endorse you. You've got to convince people that you can win. And so you've got to win the campaign in kind of behind the scenes in order to go out and win the campaign out there for votes, because you got to have the ammunition. You got to have the tools necessary to go win a campaign. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think what that does is it weeds out candidates and makes sure that somebody is Exodus 18:21, able to do the job, able to win and able to do the job before they're thrown out there on the ballot. And so it's kind of a weeding out process. I'm not for less money in politics. I like the way Tom DeLay put it. He said, we spend more money on potato chips in America than we do on our politics. We do. We spend billions more on potato chips than we do in choosing our leaders. Money is a form of expression because it helps to get the message out. If you aren't raising money as a candidate, something's wrong with your message. You're not the representative of the people if people aren't willing to invest in you so that you can go run. Now, I realize that means if somebody has a lot of money, they have a disproportionate voice. They can make their voice louder. That's part of the process. I mean, that's, I'm not sure that's all negative. So I wouldn't be for that amendment just because I'd rather leave it up to the market. And if your ideas are great, you're going to raise money. There are going to be people that will support what you're doing and want you to get your message out. Yeah. Well, I would suggest to you that that amendment is already in there. And it is the Fifth Amendment. Everybody turn to the Fifth Amendment. Page 40. Right at the bottom of the page. Nor shall any person be subject to the same offense twice in liberty, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. When the federal government comes into your property and they say to you, oh, you found a golden-cheeked warbler on your property. Why, that's an endangered species. And your property is the perfect habitat for that golden-cheeked warbler, so you can no longer use your property for anything except habitat for the golden-cheeked warbler. Thank you very much for saving the golden-cheeked warbler. And oh, by the way, we're not going to give you a penny for that. So when Margaret, I forget her last name, in Austin, Texas, had a $1 million piece of property upon which they found a golden-cheeked warbler, which is some bird I've never seen, and I don't think my life will be less of value if I ever see one or don't see one in my whole life. When they found one on her property, and they said, okay, now, endangered species on your property, you can only use it to save the golden-cheeked warbler. A week later, her property was now worth $38,000. And she couldn't do anything about it, and we didn't give her a penny. I believe we just violated the Fifth Amendment. I think we just devalued her property. We took her property in terms of value, and we did not compensate her for it. So you're dead on. There needs to be an amendment. The problem is the amendment's there, and the federal government has violated it. I am so anti-Endangered Species Act, it's unbelievable. And it's not just about birds and you know, I mean, we could probably make an argument for why the bald eagle ought to be protected, or maybe the American wolf or the grizzly bear. Yeah. But bugs and beetles and gnats and maggots, we're literally protecting maggots and now plants. And we're stopping progress and taking people's property and just, oh, it's, and all it is frankly, if I could be blunt, because I've been so, you know, perfuming it up all day, it's a bunch of 60s rejects that want to tell you how to use your property because they don't own any. They haven't been willing to go out and work hard and earn and buy property, and so they want to tell you what you can do with it. It makes me so angry. And I live in the San Francisco of the South, in Austin, Texas, where the environmental wackos run rampant there, and they want to tell everybody what they can do with their land. If you want to tell me what I can do with my land, here's how much I'm selling it for. And you can buy it, and then you can tell me what to do with it. Yes, sir. Well, I know we passed that law in Texas, a state law in Texas that says if it devalues more than 25%, then it kicks in and you have to be paid. I didn't know there was a federal. If there is a federal law that says that, they are certainly not living up to it. But we need to be suing more often on it. But anyway, private properties, it's one of the pillars. I mean, Pursuit of Happiness was originally property under John Locke. Now, Locke also is the one that created the phrase Pursuit of Happiness, that comes out of his Essay on Human Understanding, that has a whole section on it. So that's why Jefferson put those together. But, I mean, property is, man, you're dead on, brother. I'm with you. Yes, sir. Some, yes. Now, after the Kelo decision, which I think, and you know, you guys know wall builders, we're into all these religious liberty cases. But I personally think the worst Supreme Court decision in the last 50 years was Kelo, because Kelo says that the government, your local government, can take your property, state or city council, because they come up with a higher use for it. So if you're a church and you're not providing any tax base for the city, and some guy wants to put a mall in on this property right here, that the city council can condemn your property, give it to the developer, and then the developer puts them all in, and they get tax base. Kelo gave them the authority to do that. Fortunately, as soon as that passed, I think 42 of the 50 states immediately passed eminent domain restrictions that would prevent that sort of thing, where you weren't really taking it for a true public purpose. I mean, a mall is not a public use under constitutional interpretation, but under Justice Breyer and the other liberals on the court, they thought it was so. So y'all may have done that in Oregon as well. I don't know if y'all passed one of those or not. Let me get this one back here, and then I'll come back over here. Yes, sir. No, yeah, say no international law is going to be considered. In... Well, there again, I would say we don't need an amendment. I mean, it tells us that that's part of Congress's responsibility. They're supposed to be securing our border, so they're not doing their job under the Constitution now. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Good preventive measure. Yes, sir. I'm for that, baby. Let's do it. I'll second that motion, as Chuck said earlier. Absolutely. Yes, ma'am. You know, interesting. She mentioned the Federal Reserve. This is one of those areas I agree with Ron Paul very much on, the danger of the Federal Reserve and the problem with it. And, yeah, I mean, y'all heard me say good and bad things about Ron. Just so y'all know, if you're a Ron Paul supporter, I mean, I've had dinner with Ron and Carol. They're friends of mine. Ron was my congressman when I was in the legislature. We used to campaign together quite a bit. So I love the guy on a lot of stuff. I think he's totally wrong on Israel and on Islam and on foreign policy, and that's why I won't support him for president. But he is great on economics and on the Federal Reserve, and he has been defending this document better than any member of Congress for the last 50 years. So I love the guy in Congress. I just don't want him in the White House. And now I've forgotten what we were talking about. How did I get off on that? Was the old Federal Reserve. Thank you. You know, interesting, because, you know, constitutionally, I think Congress can delegate these things as they've done with the Federal Reserve. I don't think they've violated the Constitution in what they're doing. I think it's wrong what they're doing. I think it's been terrible for our economy and our monetary policy and all of those things. I 100% agree with Ron on the negative aspects of it, but I don't think it's been unconstitutional. So a constitutional amendment that would say this is not for you to give to these private bankers and we want Congress doing their job in terms of monetary policy, it would be a great idea. Yes, sir. Another interesting point, because the problem with Sharia is it trumps the Constitution if you start bringing it in, and our local laws as well. You may have read several states have attempted this. Oklahoma passed one last session. It's been ruled by the court to not be constitutional, and they struck it down. And I think their language was poorly put together in how they passed it. It might have held up had they not. In terms of an amendment to the Constitution, I don't know that we would get the momentum to do it, but I will say this. Sharia law is a real and present danger to our Constitution and our legal system in America. And I forget the National Center for Constitutional Studies did their November newsletter is a good summation of the danger of it and how often it's being used. I mean, it's not one, you know, random judge in America that has invoked in some way, shape, or form Sharia law. It's been about 100 different times. Almost every state has had an example of it. There's a real and present danger there. And if you go to NCCS, somebody look on the back of anybody got their pocket constitution handy? I always mess up their website. Oh, Dearborn's the biggest hotbed. Absolutely. Yeah. Does anybody have one of those little pocket constitutions on the back for I think it's nccs.net. If not, just grab one of the ones off the table. If you go on their website, click on newsletters, click on November 2011. They've got a quick two-page read that is much better than I'm going to do in 30 seconds on this that will tell you. It is a real day. And listen to Wall Builders Live. We do quite a few shows on this issue and have a lot of the experts on that are much more in tune to the danger and how to stop it. Yes, sir. It is net. Okay. I am the world's worst at saying net when it's org when it's com, and com when it's dot. And so thank you. Sharia law is basically what Muslims prefer is they want Sharia law to trump. If you think Taliban in Afghanistan, that's the ultimate. Okay. So Sharia law was the law of the land. And so what happens in America is the way they get the nose under the tent is they'll come in even in let's say a mediation. Or an arbitration, and they'll say to the arbitrator or the mediator, since we're both Muslims, Sharia law is important to us. We want to be ruled by the Quran, and so we want that to be considered in this mediation or this arbitration. And then if the arbitrator does that and uses Sharia law to make the decision, and under Sharia law, that means it's higher than this. That means that it trumps anything in the Constitution or in the local law. And then that arbitrator's decision, even though it only affects those two people, then that arbitrator's decision is taken into court, and given the stamp of approval by the judge, and now you've got a precedent for it's okay to consider Sharia law whenever you're deciding these issues, whether it's a family issue or whatever it might be. Those little instances are starting to stack up and stack up and stack up, and the more it happens, the more likely you're going to have people coming in that say, you can't convict me of murdering my daughter in an honor killing because under Sharia law, as a Muslim, you're violating my First Amendment freedom of religion because Sharia law trumps your law, and we're allowed under the Quran to do that because she wore a short skirt. That's, I know I'm giving an extreme, but that's where it goes. Because not for us it doesn't, but for them it does. Because it's you're taking a because the Quran says and Sharia law says that it's the highest law, regardless of where you live, and that your nation or your community has to use the Quran and use Sharia law as its as the laws for its nation. Yes, sir. Oh yeah, look on the back and tell me. Well, somebody already did, but it's .net. So now we know what the website is. Thank you, bub. Okay, next. Yes. Yes, but there are two protected classes in America right now that can do whatever they want without being criticized or everything else applying to them, and it's Muslims and homosexuals. That's pretty much the way the public perception is now. If you are for something as a Muslim or a homosexual, then if you criticize me for that, then you're intolerant. And so unfortunately, they tend to get more protections than everybody else. Martin and I always joke on Wall Builders Live about the fact that the real problem for liberals is if a Muslim and a homosexual disagree. Now, who do they side with? They don't know what to do at that point. So, yeah. Well, no, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think they have. In fact, we said on that radio program that time about Congressman Ellison. You know, one of the questions was, can he be sworn in on the Quran rather than the Bible? And the answer is yes. I mean, there's no religious test or limit. You can pick whichever for you. Makes it a solemn oath. Now, what we said at the time also was, I'm not sure it's a good idea to be sworn in on the Quran when we're in the middle of a war against radical Islam, but hey, if that's what the guy wants to do, then that's his choice. Sure. No, I mean, I'm for freedom. Let him do it that way if he wants. Yes. English as an official language. I love that. I love that. Gwen's saying, hey, they ought to have to live under every law that they force on us, which we always thought it was that way. But how many times do they exempt themselves out now? And Obamacare is a perfect example. If it's so good, why don't they want it? They've got their own system. Social Security is so good. Why don't they want it? They've got their own system. So, yes, I think that actually would be a good amendment to just essentially say you can't have different classes created by Congress. They've got to live under every law that they force us to live under. And, yeah, the pension thing. I mean, he's got $150,000 a year. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah. The hard part there is, you know, you don't know how many judges might die during those 4 years or that 8 years. Or if the population of the country grew to the point that you needed more courts. So it'd be hard to define how many I think that's part of the consequence of elections. You know, that judge is going to get, every president averages a quarter of the judiciary in their 4 years. And if they get 8 years, they get half the judiciary that they're going to appoint. So Bush got to appoint about half the judiciary. Obama's already going to end up with about 25% total, and if he gets four more years, he'll get half. And I don't know what I've never come down on a number of years, as I said earlier, 10, 12, 15. I mean, I'd be open. No, I really don't. I mean, I honestly, I don't get this Occupy Wall Street thing. I mean, the 99% versus the 1%, I mean, I'm not part of the 1%. I don't make that much money, but I don't... I'm part of the 100%, so I don't. It's a class warfare deal. The fear of corporations. I do share concern of crony capitalism and government teaming up with corporations. I have no problem with a company being as big as they want to be. People always, you know, Microsoft's too powerful and all that kind of stuff. Microsoft was one person up against the giant of IBM. Came up with better ideas and better technology. Maybe stole some of them from Steve Jobs, but they competed and went out in the marketplace and dominated the market. And then Apple does the things that they've done lately. I mean, I'm for the market and allowing that to happen. What I don't like is when government teams up with a corporation or government ever comes in and says that a company's too big to fail. There is no company too big to fail. There is no politician too big to fail. There is no country too big to fail. Failure's a good thing. We want the freedom to fail. It makes the system better when people do fail. So I share some of the concern. I think a lot of the opposition is not to big corporations as much as it is big corporations having power in government and using government to keep their power. So it's the crony capitalism that becomes a problem. Oh, yeah, yeah, no, that's their crony capitalism. That's right. I mean, unions are just big companies. And there again, it's government teaming up with a big company, in this case a union, and using government coercion to protect their own interests, which is all of my, that's what the whole all the bailouts, that's what all that was about, was protecting the unions and telling the creditors, too bad. The people that invested the money to keep the thing going, and they're the ones left out. It's a horrible abuse of government power. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that would be hard to do in terms of a constitutional amendment, but in terms of a rule for Congress, I think would be the easier way to do that. And what we did in Texas legislature is we call it germaneness. You can't add on to a bill an issue that's not germane to that particular bill. And so you don't get this Christmas tree of all these different issues, you know, that have nothing to do with the original bill. And it's the earmarks and everything else. It's part of the problem. These 2,000 page bills, nobody's even read, and you get them at midnight. And let me tell you something. You go back to this issue we talked about this morning, what we started with, the idea of right and wrong and truths. If you have a side of the debate that doesn't believe in moral absolutes, then anything goes. There are no rules. We've already had members of Congress come on our radio program and say, in our committee, the chairman, we had amendments to the bill. And we that were in the minority had enough sway and influence on the debate that we got some good amendments onto the bill. And the chairman, after the committee's over, goes to the clerk and says, when the bill goes to the floor, leave the amendments out. Now, has anybody got a problem with that? Wait a minute. You pass an amendment on a bill. That's like Congress passing an amendment on a bill on the House floor and then sending it to the Senate without the amendment, even though the representatives of the people... So rules mean nothing. Process means nothing. They don't care. The end justifies the means. They will do whatever it takes to get what they want. And that's the problem when you leave God out of the equation. It's just like capitalism. I mean, Benjamin Franklin said the free market is the means under God of establishing the freedom of our country entire and of handing it down complete to posterity. Meaning free enterprise and capitalism is essential to making all of our freedoms permeate the country and of passing the torch of freedom. But how did he say it? The free market is the means under God. That's ethical capitalism. You take God out of the equation, you take truths, you take right and wrong and moral absolutes out, and then it becomes, what my governor said, vulture capitalism instead of venture capitalism. It becomes everybody do whatever's going to make you the most money instead of respecting your neighbor. The beauty of free enterprise under God and ethical capitalism is I bless you with a product and you bless me with the money for giving you that product. We bless each other, and that's free enterprise. That works. If I'm not blessing you, if I've got a bad product and I'm cheating you or whatever, you can go down the street to somebody else, and the market works. But if you take God out of the equation and everybody's just doing whatever they can, the more you take God out, the more government has to come in and police it. Why are people calling for reforms on Wall Street and more regulation and more government control? Because we, the people, have moved away from ethics and away from God and let anything go and everything be okay. Rabbi Daniel Lapid says it better than anybody else. You're either going to have a Nimrod society or you're going to have an Abraham society. A Nimrod society, government is the center of your culture, the center of your society, and socialism prevails because government's having to control everybody and make everybody equal. When God's the center of the society and the church is the epicenter of the community and the Abraham society, then you don't need as much government. You need government, but not as much government. It's not the center. It's not the control because the morals and the ethics and the values are permeating the culture so that men will police themselves rather than having government police them. The Speaker of the House, Robert Winthrop, former Speaker, said, you're either going to be ruled by the Bible or the bayonet. If the Bible and the concept of right and wrong permeates the culture, you don't need as much government regulation and control. So that's, again, we're right back to this first thing we talked about, French Revolution versus American Revolution. If we have freedom without God in the equation, ultimately government's going to have to clamp down and use the sword to keep people from killing each other. But if you have freedom with God in the equation, then government will only have to do the things that only government is capable of doing by design. So I'm getting off on tangent. Sorry. But it's just so important to keep the ethics in this thing, whether we're talking about the marketplace or whatever it might be. Okay, potential amendments. I don't think I had any. Okay, let's see. Okay, let's jump into the. Actually, before we do the Bill of Rights, let's take a restroom break. It's 3:25. Let's start back up at 3:35. So 10-minute break. While everybody else is coming back in, I forgot one of the amendments that and I don't know that it needs to be an amendment. Actually, I think I would push for it more. It doesn't need to be an amendment. What I would push for is at the state level, a limit on attempts at a grand jury indictment. I've just seen so many abuses recently politically by politically motivated prosecutors to go after someone and convene grand jury after grand jury after grand jury until they finally get one to say yes and hand down an indictment. Tom DeLay in Austin, Texas was very much an example of this. 5 grand juries said no, he hasn't done anything wrong, and they finally got a 6th grand jury to indict and then had their political witch hunt and a show trial in Austin, Texas and got him convicted there. So anyway, that's just a pet peeve of mine. I think, you know, make your best case, get to the grand jury. If they say yes, get the indictment and move forward. If not, I think it's just as important for prosecutors to not go after good people as it is for them to go after the bad people. And sometimes we lose that balance. And I'm a tough on crime kind of guy, don't get me wrong. But the abuses can be worse than people getting away with crime. Okay, so let's jump into the Bill of Rights. First Amendment, boy, we could spend all day on this one. It's one of those areas most under attack, as well as the Second Amendment. And certainly the religious liberty cases, you know, I thought Stephen did a fantastic job at lunch in laying out some of this. Just remember, in the idea of freedom of religion, that part of the concept here is not only that I get to live out my faith and I get to enjoy expressing my faith, but also I'm going to respect those that have a different faith or no faith at all. And I think that's what we've lost a little bit of in America because Christians are the majority. We bought into this idea that our expression shouldn't be protected. It's only the one heckler. It's only the atheist or the Wiccan or whatever it might be. And so that person is allowed to stop us from expressing our faith, when in fact we should all respect each other's ability to express their faith. And if I'm offended by how you express your faith, then that's part of freedom. Declaration of Independence doesn't say life, liberty, and to never be offended. It says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I'm going to be offended sometimes. So if you're offended by the way I worship or don't worship, so be it. That's part of freedom. We should just respect other people and not run to the nearest government official and shut down that particular expression. Same thing with speech. I mean, one of the beautiful things about freedom of speech is you can say what you believe when it's not popular, when it is popular. In fact, when it's unpopular, that's what they were really wanting to protect was your political opinion, even when it was in the minority. Our ability to have a non-government-controlled media, other than CNN, of course, and NPR, I guess we have a little bit of government-controlled media, but this wonderful competition of ideas. I think that's why the alternative media is growing so rapidly in America is because of the competition. People are figuring out, I don't want this warped view. I want to be able to get an unbiased view, or I want to get a view that is biased towards my values. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I love going to websites like One News Now from American Family Association so that I can get some expert's view of a particular issue, knowing that his paradigm or her paradigm is the same as mine, rather than me getting the spinmeister from someone that believes the exact opposite of me. I think it's one area we really need to improve in the church is encouraging people to get their news from the right sources, not from these biased sources that are going to twist things so that even when you're hearing what should be good news, it's been so twisted by the people that are presenting it that you think it's bad news. That happens quite often. And speaking of good news, listen to Wall Builders Live on Fridays. Every Friday we do what we call Good News Friday, and we bring you victories from across the nation to help encourage you and to encourage us to know you can win. This system does work, and people are winning court battles, they're winning legislative battles, they're winning elections, they're winning issues in their community, and all kinds of great victories out there. So we bring you good news on our radio program every Friday. I have no idea which station we're on locally. We're on about 200 around the country. But if you go grab one of the cards out on the table for Wall Builders Live, you can go to our website. You can listen online if you want, but it also has a list of the stations. The being able to assemble, I mean, whether it's church on Sunday morning or it's a tea party or whatever it is, that freedom of being able to gather with folks that share a particular opinion on a particular issue or work with people or organize with people, is absolutely something that's got to be defended and protected there in the First Amendment. And then petitioning the government for a redress of grievances, often we think of that only as a letter to the congressman. I think we should think of it also as a letter to the editor about the congressman. That when we petition our government for redress of grievance in our culture and society today, sometimes that needs to be a public expression. It needs to be at a town hall meeting saying, why did you vote for this or why won't you vote for that? So it's not just writing the letter and petitioning for redress of grievances, but also making the case for it among our peers so that we influence those spheres of influences that God's put into our life. I would be remiss to cover the First Amendment without at least touching on the separation of church and state, even though most of you, I'm sure, are well schooled on this. You got some of David's books or my book, Freedom's Frame, that covers this in depth. Just know it's obviously not in the Constitution. You'll never find that phrase in the Constitution or the Declaration. What the First Amendment actually says is Congress shall make no law respecting establishing religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And I find it interesting that we don't think much about that second part, prohibiting the free exercise thereof. We violate that all the time, don't we? If we say to a girl she can't pray at a football game, or we prevent someone from wearing a shirt that has a cross on it, or that has that latest California school district, you can't even wear a flag, an American flag, because it might offend another student. An American flag is going to offend another student. We got bigger problems than the shirt itself. Here's where the idea comes from. In terms of the meaning of the First Amendment. Because often I'll go to law schools and I'll put that up on the screen and I'll say, First Amendment, separation of church and state, where does it come from? And they'll say, well, it's right there in the Constitution. I say, no, it's not in the Constitution. I say, yeah, it is. Separation of church and state is in the First Amendment. This is on law school campuses, okay? And I say, no, it's not in there. And I say, yeah, it is. I just took a First Amendment class. It's in the Constitution. I say, okay, everybody break out your constitutions. And right there in a law school classroom, people will tell me, well, they didn't give us a Constitution. In law school, they don't even give us a constitution. Okay, so we pass out the constitutions, and I say, open up the First Amendment, and then we read it, and they say, okay, well, it doesn't say separation of church and state. There's always at least one student that says, but that's what they meant. Okay, I'm into original intent. I'm all about what did they mean? Did they mean separation of church and state when they wrote the First Amendment? So intent is what we do in the legislature. This is the Texas House. This is where I serve. So you come into a legislative body, you get up at the front microphone, and you say, here's my idea. You lay out your bill. You wax eloquent. You tell the world why they can't survive without this piece of legislation. And then there's a back microphone right down here you can't see. And your buddy goes to the back microphone and they toss you some softball questions so you can sound smart. That's how it works. Okay, so after everybody gets through sounding real smart, then everything you say goes in the journal. Why? Because 10 years from now, that law that I just passed in the legislature, somebody's going to be debating that. And they're going to say, well, this law means this. And the other side's going to say, no, this law means that. And then what they'll do is they'll open up the journal and they'll say, well, wait a minute, Rick Green passed the law and he said right there on the floor in front of all his colleagues before they voted to say, yes, this is what the law is going to do. This is what the law is not going to do. This is how it's supposed to be applied. So what we're doing with all of this journal discussion is we're cracking open the minds of the legislators. We're getting inside and we're getting the intent of the law, the meaning behind the law. Okay, fine. So if we're getting the meaning behind the law in Texas when I pass it, can we go back and discover the meaning of the First Amendment? Can we go back to when they debated the First Amendment? And right there in the Constitution, in fact, let's just take a look at Article 1, Section 5, I believe it is, might be 6. Article 1, Section 5 on page 10. Second paragraph from the top on page 10. Each house shall keep a journal of its proceedings, and from time to time publish the same, excepting such parts as may in their judgment require secrecy, and the yeas and nays of the members of each house, either house, on any question shall, at the desire of one-fifth of those present, be entered on the journal. Why do we do that? Well, first of all, we want to know what our members are talking about and what they're up to and what the meaning behind the law is. So everything they say is going to go in the journal, unless, like we said earlier, it might be a national security issue. I mean, I got no problem with accepting such parts as may in their judgment require secrecy. Unlike the New York Times, I don't think we should advertise to our enemies what we're up to in terms of fighting our enemies. So it's good for them to have some things they can accept from the journal. But for the most part, everything they say on the floor of the House and the Senate is going to go in the journal from the very beginning. That was in the original Constitution. And so even the First Amendment, which they debated in that first Congress, for months they talked about the Bill of Rights. For months they talked about, here's what it's going to do, here's what it's not going to do. Here's how far we want it to go, how far we don't want it to go. So if you want to know what the original intent of the First Amendment is, go read the journal. Go find out what those guys were saying on the House floor when they debated it, or on the Senate floor. And through months of debate, as you're talking about the First Amendment, how many times do we find that phrase, separation of church and state? None. Not one time do you see that phrase in the entire journal. But that's the intent of it. That's what these law students are telling you. That's what they meant. That's the intent. If that's the intent, you'd think they would have said it. We can go back to the Constitutional Convention. They debated, they talked about the concept of a First Amendment freedom of religion, and never once do they say the phrase separation of church and state. You actually have to fast forward more than a decade after the Constitution is adopted, after the Bill of Rights is adopted and the First Amendment is put into the Constitution, to find the phrase. It was one founding father in one letter, not an act of Congress, not a law. This was Thomas Jefferson writing a letter to the Danbury Baptist Association. He's responding to their letter. Their letter to Thomas Jefferson was, we're concerned about the First Amendment. We're concerned that by putting freedom of religion into the Constitution in the way that we did, somebody 100 years from now is going to look back and say, government gave us the freedom of religion. Government can take it away. We might forget that God gave us the freedom of religion, and God gave us these freedoms, and government's job is to protect them. See, a lot of people think today the Bill of Rights and these things we're studying, that the founders gave us that. No, the founders said in the Bill of Rights, your freedom of religion, God gave you that. And what we're saying in the Constitution is we can't touch it. Our job is to make sure we don't violate that freedom that God gave you. We're not giving it to you. God gave it to you. Our job is to protect it. So the Danbury Baptists were concerned. And if you think about it, they had reason to be concerned. I mean, you look in Virginia where Jefferson came from. Baptists were persecuted. I mean, look, you had Baptist ministers killed. So they had a reason to be concerned about the freedom of religion. And Jefferson, in fact, they said to him, Mr. President, we're glad you got elected president. We're glad we supported Jefferson. Baptists supported Jefferson across the country because he had been a champion for religious liberty. And so anyway, they go through this whole thing. We're concerned. He writes them back. He says, look, here's the deal. You don't have to worry, because this amendment is actually protecting your free exercise of religion. Government will not tell you as a church how to live out your freedom of religion, and will not violate your freedom of religion unless you're, quote, subverting the public good, meaning child sacrifice. Some goofy, you know, think about some radical religion that goes out there and starts, you know, sacrificing children or doing something that's against the public good. Then government's got the right to come in and say, we're not going to allow that to happen. But other than that, don't worry, government's going to stay out of your way. The whole idea of the First Amendment is to protect your free exercise thereof. His letter gets virtually ignored. He writes a letter to the Danbury Baptist. Nobody talks about it. It gets quoted in about 6 federal cases in 150 years. So over the next 150 years, we find Jefferson's letter quoted about 6 times. And every time they quote the entire letter, and they use it as evidence of the fact that we're a religious nation. So wait a minute, separation of church and state in Jefferson's letter is evidence of the fact that we're a nation of faith? Yes, that's how they did it for the 150 years. Then, all of a sudden, 1947, one case, the Everson case, Hugo Black is on the Supreme Court. He's a KKK guy, and he's on the Supreme Court, and he hands down this decision in Everson. He says, he quotes the 8 words out of Jefferson's letter, leaves out the rest of the letter, and he takes the wall of separation of church and state, and he says, see here, Jefferson told us, First Amendment is all about a wall of separation of church and state. He said it's a high and impregnable wall, and we have to keep religion away from the state, and we're not going to allow in any way these two to come together, and no way for education to ever allow for religion. And he creates this sudden separation of church and state that is totally the opposite of what Thomas Jefferson was talking about in his letter. In fact, turn to the First Amendment with me. Those two parts of the first phrase in the First Amendment. This idea of the, as Stephen mentioned at lunch, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. Bottom of page 38. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's known as the Establishment Clause. That means Congress, hands off. You cannot create a national denomination. That's all they were talking about, the Church of England. We don't want a Church of England. Now, at the time that the First Amendment was adopted, the time it was implemented, you had state religions, not a problem. They didn't have any problem with that. They did not want a national denomination or national religion, comma, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So in legal phraseology, you've got two phrases here. The Establishment Clause, government, federal government cannot have a national denomination, and the Free Exercise Clause, government cannot interfere with your freedom of religion and prevent you from living out your faith. Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist was all about the free exercise clause. He was all about saying, we're going to protect your ability to live out your faith. Hugo Black takes Jefferson's words in his letter and takes them off of the free exercise clause and applies them to the establishment clause. Horrible jurisprudence. Sloppy jurisprudence. Purposeful jurisprudence. He was trying to create this new separation of church and state that had nothing to do with our history, our precedent, or our Constitution. Totally distorted it. And so then he takes Jefferson's words and applies them to the Establishment Clause. And now, for 60 years later, that one decision has been quoted. That phrase, separation of church and state, you know how many times it's been quoted in the last 60 years? 7 times in 150 years, 7,000 times in the last 60 years. You know how many times we've quoted the First Amendment itself, the actual words of the First Amendment? 3,500. Half as often. So twice as often, we quote the words of one man in one letter instead of quoting the actual meaning of the Constitution. Now, here's the really bad part. We took the words of this guy, and now if I pass the law in Texas, and I'm the one on the floor passing that law, it's appropriate for you to take my words and use that to determine the intent of the law, right? That makes sense. What if I'm not one of the legislators? What if I'm vacationing in Oregon or Washington, and I'm not even part of that law? Would it be appropriate for you to quote me in terms of what that law means? Of course not. But what if you show up for a trial, and the judge says, if you witnessed the murder, we're really not interested in your testimony, but if you weren't anywhere around, you didn't see anything, you didn't hear anything, and you were in another state at the time, you're the eyewitness we want. We would all say that's nuts, right? When you take separation of church and state and apply it to the First Amendment, you just took a witness and asked them to testify to a murder that they weren't even in the same state when it occurred, and they had absolutely nothing to do with it. Thomas Jefferson had nothing to do with the First Amendment to the Constitution. He had nothing to do with the Constitution, frankly. We all know him as the author of the Declaration of Independence, but he did not give us the Constitution. He wasn't one of the 55 guys that framed the Constitution. He wasn't one of the 90 congressmen that passed the Bill of Rights and put it into the Constitution. He wasn't involved in the debates at the state level. He didn't have anything to do with it other than one or two letters back and forth with James Madison. In fact, a biographer writes him a letter and says, hey, I wrote a biography about you and I want to make sure I'm accurate. Sends him the whole biography. Jefferson reads through the whole biography, writes the guy back, and he says, one passage in the paper you enclosed me must be corrected. It's the following. I'll say it was yourself more than any other individual that planned and established the Constitution. He said, wait, I didn't plan and establish the Constitution. He said, I was in Europe when the Constitution was planned. Never even saw it till after it had been established. We just cracked open the wrong head, didn't we? We're taking the words of a guy that had nothing to do with the First Amendment and applying his words to be the meaning of the Constitution, meaning of the First Amendment. It's terrible jurisprudence. It's been an absolute lie for 60 years, and it's become so much a part of our vernacular in America. You ask most people what separation of church and state is, they think it's in the Constitution. They think that those words are actually there. It's the words of one man that wasn't even part of the Constitution. Those are the guys we ought to be quoting. If you really want to know the intent of the First Amendment, you ought to be going to these guys. You ought to be going and quoting the people that were actually in Congress. How about the Speaker of the House at the time? Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg, a pastor in Congress. You think a pastor is going to adopt an amendment that says, that's going to prevent people from living out their faith and prevent people from exercising their faith? How about Frederick Augustus's brother, who's also in Congress at the time? John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg, another pastor from Virginia. What about James Madison, father of the Constitution? You know what he said about the First Amendment? He said, all we're doing is we're preventing a single national denomination. That's it. Separation of church and state is, now, we want a separation of the institutions, don't we? We all do. We don't want the Church of England. That phrase goes back to Reverend Hooker. It goes all the way back 400 years to the concept of what the separatists and the Puritans and everybody else wanted. We wanted to separate the institutions. I don't want my pastor to be the head of the entire religion community in America and president of the United States. I don't want that. I don't want the president to be the head of the church. I don't want the head of the church to be the president. But I want the president to be able to be part of the church. I want, as a member of the church, to be able to be part of government. We can move back and forth between the institutions. We just don't want the institutions to be the same. Does that make sense? See the difference between the two? This has been totally distorted from what it originally meant. And Madison had it right. Single national denomination. We've got to remember there are two parts to the First Amendment, freedom of religion. There's the prohibition on government creating a national denomination, and then there's the protection of our individual expressions. And we've ignored that part for too long, and we've allowed the court to violate this thing. Last thing I'll say on Jefferson real quick, because people have a warped view. I had a warped view of Jefferson. I thought he was a very anti-religion, anti-Christianity guy because of the things I was taught in law school and the things you read and the things you hear about Jefferson. When Jefferson wrote that letter, it was January 1st, 1802, when he penned that letter that talked about separation of church and state. He was president of the United States at the time. 2 days later, he attended church. Guess where he attended church? Supposed to be this anti-religious guy, but he attended church 2 days later after he wrote the letter, separation of church and state. Guess where he went to go to church that day? The United States Capitol. Federal property. Now, wait a minute. If separation of church and state means what our court today says it means, then the guy that coined the phrase violated it 2 days after he wrote it in a letter, right? Because he's attending church on federal property. It was the largest church, one of the largest churches in America. Four different churches were meeting at the United States Capitol. Guess who started church services at the Capitol? Thomas Jefferson. He's the guy, he's the vice president at the time, in charge of the Senate, and together was opening up the Capitol to allow for these churches to meet there on federal property. He attended church at the Capitol throughout his presidency. Read John Quincy Adams and all these other guys talking about what an example the president made by attending church. And somebody asked him, why are you attending church? Well, at the United States Capitol. In fact, John Leland, a Baptist, by the way, was the one preaching that Sunday morning 2 days after he wrote the letter on January 1st. Somebody asked him, why aren't you attending church on Sunday morning at the Capitol? He said, no nation has ever existed or been governed without religion, nor can be. The Christian religion is the best religion that has been given to man, and I, as chief magistrate of this nation, am bound to give it the sanction of my example. That's the great secularist? That's the guy that's supposed to want to hate religion, hate Christianity? Let me tell you something. There are things about Thomas Jefferson that will blow your mind. David Barton's got a book coming out in 2 months you have got to get. It is called The Jefferson Lies. And it goes through this step by step. It'll blow your mind in terms of, I learned things in this about Jefferson. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, I've always thought of him as an anti-religion guy. Up until the last 15 years of his life, this man was so pro-Christian. I mean, everything from the divinity of Christ to the virginity of Mary to, I mean, you go through the whole thing. And he was absolutely a defender of all those things. He got caught up in a big movement in Virginia the last 15 years of his life and denounced a lot of the major tenets of Christianity. But for the vast majority of his life, he was right there with us. And even in those last 15 years, he didn't become the anti-Christian guy that he is portrayed to be today. So Jefferson Lies, get that book. It'll be out in about 2 months. David Barton and Thomas Nelson is the one publishing it. I say 2 months. I'm hoping it's quicker than that, but it may not be. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. First of all, I will say none of them were saints. All of them were sinners just like us. So they had their flaws just like us. But their flaws are so overblown today to make us feel better about the what's the word I'm looking for? The starts with a D. Indecency, whatever, of our culture today. We try to make ourselves feel better by saying, well, see, the founders did bad things, too. Yes, in Jefferson Lies, we cover the issue of the whole idea of Sally Hemings. Did he father have children with one of his slaves, Sally Hemings? We disprove that, which, by the way, even the people that did the DNA testing that was reported in 900 and some odd publications in America, 6 weeks later, the same people went back and redid all their testing and said it couldn't have been Thomas Jefferson. It might have been his brother, but there's no way it could have been Thomas Jefferson, and their own DNA testing proved, but nobody covered it in the news. We could jump on a bunch of these, but Franklin and all the supposed how bad he was and orgies and all that kind of stuff. There's just, yes, you will find a sordid affair here or a sordid affair there of one or two founding fathers, no different than our culture today. But what we do, and I'm trying to think of the right phrase here. It's not minimalism. It's deconstructionism. What we do is we take one example of 250 men and we try to apply that to all of them. We try to take the one bad example and say, see, they were all just as bad as anybody else today, instead of saying, you're going to have one crack in the foundation or one flaw in the painting, But that doesn't mean that the whole thing is bad. And that's how people tear down the founding fathers, is they'll take one thing that they did and try to apply it to all the founding fathers or even to that person. I mean, I'm not saying Jefferson was a holy man at all. He was a sinner just like all of us and certainly had his faults. But the things that we do to tear these guys down in order to tear down their ideas and tear down their principles really is bad. And that's what David really addresses in the book Jefferson Lies. And he goes through the whole concept of deconstructionism, post-structuralism, minimalism, the tools that actually Stephen was beginning to touch on in his lunch topic that the historians, quote unquote, of today use to tear down the old, to destroy the foundations so that they can create this new world. They have to first destroy where we came from. And, you know, gosh, I don't know. We can touch on it, any of them if you want. I'm trying to remember some more off the top of my head that I could do in 30 seconds. Yeah. They do. No. We're winning most of these battles now. Because the history's on our side, because the Constitution's on our side, the precedent's on our side, the reason we lost for so long is we didn't have the boots on the ground. We didn't have the attorneys with the knowledge to go in and fight. 15, 20 years ago, you had guys like Jay Sekulow and ACLJ, Alliance Defense Fund started, Pacific Justice Institute out here on the West Coast, Liberty Council, Liberty Institute, all these groups started up. And now we've got about 2,000 attorneys out there across the country, so that if your school district or your church or whatever gets sued by the ACLU, we can be there in an instant. And when guys like Stephen end up in their situation, he called on Alliance Defense Fund. That's who came to his aid. Now we've got not only the troops, but we've got the judges that are coming out of these good law schools like Liberty Law School and Regents that know the history, not just the indoctrination of the Harvard, as Stephen was saying, but the truth of what the founders actually said. And now you're getting some good judges on the bench as well. So we're winning battle after battle as a result. I mean, I my friends at Liberty Council, Matt Staver, those guys, they've been up against the ACLU, I don't know how many times. They've won 94% of their cases. 94% of the time they win. Why? Because the law's on our side. The Constitution's on our side. The precedent's on our side. The problem we have, the challenge we have, is the way that the funding mechanism works. The ACLU gets their attorney's fees when they win an establishment. Remember the two phrases I just listed? If an establishment case is won, they get their attorney's fees. If we win a free exercise case for Stephen or whoever else, we don't get attorney's fees. So they're funding to the tunes of millions of dollars with taxpayer dollars. That's why they're able to meet us toe-to-toe right now. But most of the time, we win if we show up. If a lot of times, schools cower down. When the ACLU shows up and they threaten to sue your school district because some kid has a Christmas tree or invites other kids to a prayer group on campus, the school district will immediately shut down and give in to the ACLU because they're afraid of the $500,000 lawsuit. And that's why we lost for a long time. Now our guys show up and say, we're going to sue you if you don't let the kid live out their constitutional principles. And so that's why we're winning more and more those cases. We're starting to turn this around. We're starting to win in not just on the facts in the court cases, but in the knowledge of the American people. More and more people understand the real history of separation of church and state, and it's not just a given like it used to be. Yeah. It's a quirk in federal law, and we've tried to get, we've come close, we've passed in the House to shift that and actually reverse it. I'd be for either way, just say, hey, if you win on the merits, you ought to get your attorney's fees. But it's just a quirk, and it's been for 15 years, the ACLU has benefited from it. Okay, by the way, just a side note, if you look at the, for people that say Jefferson was anti-Christian and all that, you can look at the way that they signed the Constitution in the year of our Lord. That meant something. That's invoking the Gregorian calendar. That's saying, look, we understand that there's a higher law in addition to this law. The Founding Fathers would sign often in the year of our Lord. George Washington would sign in the year of our Lord, Adams in the year of our Lord, Madison in the year of our Lord. Hey, you would think the great secularists would say no to this, right? I mean, he's not going to want to sign a document as President of the United States. Said, actually, one of our documents in David Barton's collection, he's signing not only in the year of our Lord, he signs in the year of our Lord Christ. So that's your great secularist, Thomas Jefferson, even invoking not only the Gregorian calendar, but Christ himself. Reagan, where are you, bud? Come on in here. I want you to help me on the Second Amendment. Can you hear me, Reagan? Reagan Green, paging Reagan Green. Come on up, bud. I want you to tell everybody about the Second Amendment. So y'all welcome Reagan. He's going to take over for about 5 minutes here. don't know what happened to that handheld. I'll let you use this one. Yeah, go for it. You can do it.
He hadn't done this one in a while, so y'all.
Richard Henry Lee was the founding father in the Continental Congress who made the motion for America's independence on June 7, 1776. Lee once said, "To preserve liberty, it is essential that the whole body of all people possess arms and be taught how to use them, especially when young." This might explain why John Quincy Adams, 6th President of the United States, was out with the Massachusetts Minutemen doing musket drills when he was only 8 years old. The Founding Fathers said that the Second Amendment is the one that protects all our other freedoms. It says, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." At that time, the militia was every man that could fire a rifle. So this freedom wasn't for the official military, it was for we the people, which is why it says, "The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Even if you don't like hunting or guns as much as our family, you would be wise to help protect the rights of other families like ours so we can keep our guns, just in case someday we need to use those guns to help protect your rights.
Good gentleman.
All right. There you go. And yes, we'll be having shooting lessons out in the parking lot right after the class. So, all right, Third Amendment, according to soldiers. Let's just run through these real quick. We're not going to dive too deep, but we'll just get an idea of where they are. Third Amendment, the idea is, look, we don't want the U.S. government to do what the British were doing. One of the big problems in the Revolutionary War was you had the forcing of quartering soldiers, often when the husband is off fighting the war, and now you got British soldiers actually taking over the homes when the wife and the kids are there. Bad, bad, bad situation. Bad things happen. So they put into the Constitution, you can't do that at a time of peace without the permission of the homeowner, or at a time of war, unless it's in a manner prescribed by law. And so what that means is, if we were in a time of war, let's say the movie Red Dawn comes true, okay? If the movie Red Dawn happens, I want the soldiers staying at my house, okay? But it'd be a manner prescribed by law. If I'm not the one actually fighting, I'm going to feed and clothe and shelter those American soldiers to fight back. So that's basically the way it works. I don't see that as a negative, and it hasn't, of course, been an issue since the time of the Constitution. Fourth Amendment. Got a lot in the Fourth Amendment, and boy, we could debate all day long just the issue of the TSA. Short answer, yes, I think the TSA is violating your Fourth Amendment rights with the pat-downs and all that. In Texas, we actually passed, almost got it into law, a complete ban on these, frankly, fondling of passengers coming through the airport. And unfortunately, our lieutenant governor catered on us. But anyway, so Fourth Amendment deals with searches and seizures. We could go through one by one on those, but let's just stick with the big broad strokes here. Fifth Amendment, a lot in the Fifth Amendment. We mentioned earlier the private property takings clause. I think that's the area of the Fifth Amendment most under, in fact, one of the areas of the Constitution, most under attack and violated the most often. But there's a lot in here. Grand jury, your right against double jeopardy, self-incrimination. Of course, that's the one we always think of, right? We all say, I plead the Fifth, so I don't have to incriminate myself. And then due process. So a big bundle in the Fifth Amendment of rights. Sixth Amendment, same thing. You got a lot here, and it has to do with being able to have your speedy public trial, call witnesses for yourself, or to confront witnesses against you, and your right to counsel or an attorney. Doesn't mean that we're going to constitutionally have to pay for that. I think it's a good custom in America that we have always said, if you're in jeopardy of life or limb and can't afford counsel, we will provide that for you. I think that's a good thing. Seventh Amendment, your right to a jury trial when dealing in a civil case. But this one, there's a big hurdle. Somebody read for us there in the Seventh Amendment. You got a lot of money's got to be at stake here for you to be guaranteed your jury trial. Who wants to read Seventh Amendment real quick for us so we know how much money's got to be at stake? $20. So unless you're suing the gumball manufacturer for getting the wrong ring, you're going to have your right to a jury trial in a civil case. Eighth Amendment, excessive fines and bail, cruel and unusual punishment, which means if you go to jail, of course, you're supposed to have 3 square meals and a color television. Not exactly. But it's not quite as bad as it was in the late 80s and 90s when the federal courts took over our judicial system, our jails across the across the nation, and we're practically guaranteeing those things. I'm kind of for busting rocks, and I think the founding fathers were too. Ninth Amendment. This is the exact opposite of what we talked about earlier in terms of enumerated rights, enumerated powers. The federal government has a specifically limited enumerated powers. That's the bucket we talked about this morning. Individuals, what the Ninth Amendment is saying is, even though we point to certain rights that you have in the Constitution, it is not an exhaustive list of individual freedoms. So that's what the Ninth Amendment says. Now, some people say, well, that means that there's a right to privacy that I can find in the Constitution. And the Ninth Amendment, therefore, gives me the power to find a right to an abortion in the Constitution. The problem with that is you cannot find a right in the Constitution that violates the Constitution. You cannot find a right in the Constitution that violates the Declaration, which is part of the Constitution, incorporated in Article in the Attestation Clause of Article 7, and everything is dated back to the Declaration. That's why the founders date the country back to the Declaration, not the Constitution, because it's all taken together. So how can you take the philosophy? Remember we said the slab, the foundation the Constitution was built upon is the Declaration? How can you say that the purpose of government is to secure life, to protect life, and then say, I'm going to find this right somewhere in here for a right to abortion to take life that for 200 years nobody ever thought was in the Constitution? It's crazy. That's why, actually, conservatives and liberals alike tell you that Roe v. Wade is bad law. What they mean by that is it's made up out of thin air without any precedent, creating this sudden right to an abortion in the Constitution that nobody, I mean, Justice Scalia says it better than anybody else. How did we suddenly in 1972 find a right in the Constitution that hadn't existed for 200 years before? That's just making it up on the spot, making up laws. So don't let people fool you with the Ninth Amendment and say, see right there it says there's rights in the Constitution that aren't listed, like abortion. No, it means there's rights and freedoms that you naturally have that are part of what the Declaration calls the laws of nature and nature's God. Which does not mean, by the way, I keep getting off on tangents, but laws of nature and nature's God was not some New Age, French Enlightenment, everybody hold hands and feel good and sing kumbaya. Okay, that wasn't just some made up kind of thing. James Wilson, who we mentioned earlier, second most active at the convention, was very specific in his writings. The laws of nature and nature's God very specifically meant, everybody back then understood it to mean, God has revealed himself to us in his written word and in nature. That even if you never got your hands on a Bible and read a Bible, you could look at the world and how nature operates and you would learn and understand that there is a God. There is a creator that put this in motion. And then through his written word, he tells us how we should operate in that world. That's what laws of nature and nature's God meant. And so when you say there are other rights and other freedoms, it's all part of that laws of nature and nature's God, not in violation of the other parts of the Constitution and the Declaration. So anyway, I get off on tangents, and I'm going to make us go late because I keep getting off on tangents. And then 10th Amendment we talked about earlier in terms of that defines there's three buckets. The bucket of rights we've given or powers we've given to government or loaned to government, I should say. The powers we've taken away from the states, and everything else is left to we the people and the states. So there you have the Bill of Rights. Lots in there. Keep your cheat sheet handy. Tape it into the back of your Constitution made easy if you want to be able to quickly glance and be able to identify where each and every one of those individual freedoms are. Let me summarize what to do, what not to do, and then maybe we'll have some time left. I intended to be to questions by now, but I got to cover a couple of things before we close. What not to do, okay? We got all this stuff in the Constitution and things we need to do as citizens. What not to do? First of all, we don't give up, okay? If my predictions are wrong, if we get four more years of this president and this philosophy, If people give up and go home and stop being involved, and all of a sudden America looks like nobody wants to study the Constitution anymore, nobody wants to come to any of my classes, if all of my predictions are wrong, that is not cause for you to give up. If everybody else in the country gives up, that is not cause for you to give up. We don't do our duty because we think we might win. We do our duty because God said, do your duty. There's a whole parable about the idea that the master doesn't come in and say to the servant, okay, now let me wait on you and let me you know feed you and all that. The servant's been out there working all day long, and now they got to come in and prepare the meal for the master. And what Jesus was saying was, don't expect praise for what you're doing. Don't only do it because it feels good or because somebody's patting you on the back. You just do your duty. You do your duty without the praise. You do your duty without knowing how it's going to turn out. Same thing for us. We don't check out or give up. I gave my dad such a hard time. He called me back when Bush was in office, and you might remember when one of the Supreme Court nominations came up, President Bush nominated a gal from Texas named Harriet Myers, not a proven conservative constitutionalist. And my dad calls and he says, "That's it. I'm done. I've been working my tail off for these people and blah, 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 blah." And we get stabbed in the back like this. He's, "I'm at it. I'm not getting involved anymore." So he's kind of like a lot of people today that are get frustrated. They say, "It's all over. Grab your guns and canned food. Go hide out at the ranch." I mean, they have given up on America. They could light up this room by leaving. You know, they just depress everybody. It's like they got this black cloud that follows them around. My friend Dr. Jarvis says they got mental B.O. You know, they've been weaned on a pickle. They drink milk out of a churn. I mean, they just depress everybody. They're like the 10 spies that came back from the Promised Land. You remember those guys? They said, "Oh, it's too hard. The giants are too big. We couldn't possibly win." The Bible says they depress the people and an entire generation had to die in the wilderness because of it. I think it's crazy to be like that. Let's be like Joshua and Caleb. They saw the same giants. They saw the same challenges, but they came home and they said, "Yes, they're giants. Yes, it's going to be hard. Yes, it's going to take a lot of work, but God's given us the land and we can win. Let's go take the land." That's the attitude that we need to have. So after my dad says, "I'm done. I'm not going to be involved anymore because I don't like the results that I'm seeing," I gave my dad a good tongue lashing. I told him everything he had told me growing up about not giving up and staying in the fight. And you do your duty regardless. And now he's chairman of the Republican Party in his county and he's involved 18 hours a day working to save the country. So he got it and he understood we don't give up no matter what the results are. So all I'm saying is you might be encouraged today to see so many others wanting to study the Constitution, to know that I've had, almost 3,000 people come through this class and another several thousand that have watched it on DVD, to know that there's other people out doing the same thing, that more and more people are getting involved. Be encouraged. But if all those results suddenly change overnight, that doesn't mean give up. No matter what the results, we stay involved. And of course, even in that case, Harriet Myers, they withdrew the nomination. And we actually got a good justice on the court. Don't give up. That's number one. What we don't do is we don't give up no matter the results. I think the results are going to be great, but I could be wrong. Second thing we don't do, we don't use violence or intimidation, no matter how motivated we are, right? We don't have to revolt with bullets. We get to revolt with balance. Our founders put in place a system where we can have a revolution in our country without ever having to take up arms. We don't have to, because they were willing to give their lives or fortunes of sacred honor, because they gave everything to put in place a system where now we can give just a little bit of our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, a little bit of our time, a little bit of our money. And our sacred honor, that's the courage to speak the truth regardless of what people say about it. So we don't have to take up bullets. We can take up ballots and we can peaceably work this process. There is no, you know, those people that think it's time to take up arms, they're off. We're not even close to exhausting the peaceable means that we have under this system right here to save our country. Not even anywhere close. So don't get up and all that kind of stuff. I know I'm preaching to the choir here. I know you're not going to do that, but just know we don't have to do that. We can peaceably save the system. So then one other thing that we don't want to do, or do we want to do it? And that is to nullify or not to nullify. Now, this doesn't have near the momentum it had 2 years ago, but I still do it in every class because there's a lot of people that want to use state nullification to rein in the federal government. And the question is, did the founding fathers, the framers of our government, give states the constitutional power to nullify federal laws? Do states have the power to nullify or stop a federal law on their own? One state nullify a federal law. It's not a new concept. It's been tried from the beginning of the country. First time there was a real effort for it was in the 1800s, in 1800, with the Alien and Sedition Acts. What happened was you had President Adams involved in the XYZ affair with the French. It was a quasi-French war. It was very unpopular. A lot of people were complaining about the president's policies and what he was doing. It was a whole diplomatic affair that most people didn't know the details of. And bottom line is people were saying, we don't like what's happening. And so people started criticizing the president and criticizing the Congress. It was a Federalist Congress and a Federalist president. So they passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, a set of four laws. Some of them were to deal with French citizens that were in America subverting our government and spying. Some had to do with American citizens that were working against the government. And it included a law that said, you cannot criticize the president's policy. Now, that would obviously be unconstitutional to all of us, right? That's anti-free speech. That's anti a lot of things. And it actually was implemented. You had 25 folks arrested simply for criticizing the president. One of them was a newspaper guy, wrote an article, he gets arrested. and imprisoned for this. Now, we would all be up in arms and saying, no, this is wrong, this is unconstitutional, and that's what happened. The whole nation, you had a lot of people up in arms over this, including the vice president, which was Thomas Jefferson, which happened to be running against John Adams at the time, and there was nothing in the Alien and Sedition Act about criticizing the vice president. You can criticize him all you want, just can't criticize the president. So Thomas Jefferson obviously says, bad deal, this shouldn't be a law. Jefferson works to help the Kentucky resolution be passed, Madison works to help the Virginia resolution be passed, and all the people that are for state nullification today go to these two resolutions and say, you see, the founding fathers were for nullification, Jefferson and Adams both. And you go to the resolutions, and you actually read the resolutions, they do say that the Alien and Sedition Acts are altogether void and of no force, that the acts aforesaid are unconstitutional. That's strong language. They did not seek to act alone. They didn't say that we as an individual state are nullifying that law. It is now null and void based on what our own actions are. What they said was, that's what should happen, and we're asking all the other states to join us in this. And they sent their resolutions to the other states. All the other states said no. Why would all the other states say no? This was a very unpopular law. It was exactly like Obamacare today. Very, very unpopular. And yet the other states said, we have three problems with this. There's three reasons we don't think this is a good idea. First of all, they said proper authority for determining constitutionality is at the federal level, not the state level. A federal law has to be determined, constitutional or not constitutional, at the federal level. One state can't decide for the whole country whether or not a federal law is constitutional or not. Then they said this would undermine the federal election process. I mean, think about it. Even if I don't like the law that's passed, like Obamacare, those were the representatives of the people. We had elections all across the nation to elect a Congress and a president. If they pass a law that I don't like in Texas, that doesn't mean, even if 90% of Texans say that's a bad law, we as Texans don't have the right to overrule the whole country. That would be the minority overruling the majority. Then they said it's of a dangerous tendency. There's all kinds of quotes from these legislatures back and forth saying, hey, we think it's a bad idea because it's going to create anarchy. I mean, if you can nullify one law, you can nullify any law. I mean, it may be a very unpopular law, but if you nullify that one, what if you nullify all the other laws and then it creates total chaos? Those are all the attempts at nullification throughout America's history. Every time, it's failed, other than Georgia and the Indian tribes, just simply because Georgia got what they wanted, because John Quincy Adams blinked and gave in. So you got all these examples, but James Madison was not for nullification. He said a more fatal inlet to anarchy cannot be imagined. It's a deadly poison to the Constitution. John Quincy Adams said a monstrous and horrible object, pretentious and fatal to the prospect and welfare of this union. They did not support the idea of state nullification. They said that it would actually allow the minority to trump the majority. And you pick the issue. I mean, we could pick abortion. We could pick immigration. We could pick marriage, whatever it is. If the federal government, if the Congress adopts a strong immigration, anti-illegal immigration law, Massachusetts and California will nullify. If the federal government adopts some strong pro-marriage or pro-life legislation, liberal states would nullify. If it's anti-life and anti-marriage, conservative states will nullify. I mean, there's always going to be a losing side, folks, no matter which way you slice it. And I'm not always going to be on the winning side. I think Sam Adams is right. As it becomes a citizen, I will acquiesce in the choice of a majority of the people. I may lose, but I'm going to acquiesce in the majority while I fight to change that and win the country over and get it back on the right side. Doesn't mean I'll lay over. Just like Steve was saying, I'm not going to be a doormat, but I am going to obey the law in the meantime and work to change it. There are only two ways to solve this problem. We don't fix the Constitution by breaking the Constitution. And state nullification breaks the Constitution. You got two options. You convince a majority of the nation to reverse course. That's exactly what happened. Alien Sedition Acts were so unpopular that the Anti-Federalists mopped the floor with the Federalists in 1800. I mean, they wiped out the Federalists in Congress. Jefferson defeats Adams, pardons the guys that had been arrested. They get the laws off the books and totally new Congress. The Anti-Federalists take over in Congress, and they fix the problem. Same thing's happening right now in America. Democrats pass Obamacare, extremely unpopular. The people are responding. A lot of people calling for state nullification. Wrong way to do it. We convinced the majority of the nation to reverse course. We did it in the House already. We'll do it in the Senate this year. Or you convince the courts to rule it unconstitutional, which we've already talked about and how that would work. And I'm all for firing both bullets. I say you fire every weapon you got on this thing. So you fight it in the nation to change the Congress and overturn the law. You fight it in the courts to try to get it ruled unconstitutional. And frankly, at this point, I think we're in a race, whether it's going to be the Congress that overturns it first or the courts that overturn it. And either way, we win. Bottom line is what George Washington said. He reminded Americans that changes must be made only by using the way which the Constitution designates. Let there be no change by usurpation. For though this in one instance may be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. So, bottom line, state nullification, bad idea. Don't jump on that bandwagon. I would love to have a silver bullet. Believe me, I would love for it to be easy. I think Texans are smarter than the rest of the country, and we ought to be able to overrule when the rest of the country does something bad. But that's not the way it works. We are a nation. I'm also not for secession. I'm not for any of those things. We're in this thing together, and we need to be working to get the rest of the country convinced to get back on the right track. State nullification is not the way to do it. Yes, sir. Who says Texans don't support? Huh? Who says we don't support it? I know. Who says we don't support Arizona? I mean, what makes you think Texas doesn't support Arizona enforcing a federal law? Well, actually, what Arizona's doing is the exact opposite of nullification. Arizona's following the federal law, and the feds are trying to nullify the state law the federal law through the states. It's a totally screwed up deal. It's bad policy from the administration. I totally support what Arizona's doing. Yeah. If they're considered an enemy combatant, I think if someone is picked up on the battlefield, like the guy that was fighting for the Taliban, I don't think they should have the same constitutional rights that you have here in America. I mean, the difference is, and this whole issue of the Patriot Act and a lot of these things that are happening and bringing terrorists into America and trying them in courts and that sort of thing. We got to remember that when you're at a time of war, hopefully it won't become as bad as what Lincoln had to do in the Civil War, and he suspended habeas corpus in the Civil War. There are a lot of civil rights issues that become issues in war, but I haven't seen anything or a violation at any level on the against citizens at this point that I've been concerned. Mm-hmm. So somebody handed me a piece of paper on it earlier. I haven't seen a situation that in my opinion, violates the Constitution. If we'll see. I mean, let's see how this thing fleshes out and how it's going to be implemented. But the only example I know of that has been close to the mark is people saying you shouldn't be able to eavesdrop on my phone conversation, for instance, under the Patriot Act. I would agree with that unless you're talking to someone in Yemen that is a suspected terrorist. I think that we should be able to eavesdrop on that conversation if we're going to protect the United States. So there are times when government has to be empowered to stop acts of violence. And if you've got somebody that's on a terrorist watch list, I think you're at a time of war, you're going to have to have a delicate balance. I think we've done a pretty darn good job in America at balancing the civil rights in a situation where you've got to have tools to fight an enemy that will take advantage of our Constitution and our freedoms if we let them. They will defeat us if we allow them to take our own freedoms and use them against us. And I think the extreme of that is allowing a Justice Department to take enemy combatants and bring them in and give them constitutional rights. It's easier, much easier to say, I'm against suspending your constitutional rights unless you are on the battlefield taking up arms against America. If I don't do that, then you, an enemy combatant that is fighting against America, has more rights than a soldier in the United States Army. Because if we go back and read those rights in the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, we will find that it does not apply to a soldier that's in the middle of a war. And I agree with, I forget the federal judge's name 80 years ago, that said that why would we give more rights to an enemy combatant than we give to our own soldiers? There are certain precautions that have to be taken at a time of war. And I know I'm stepping on toes here, and I don't want to take too much time debating this. So let me grab these two, and if they don't take us too far, because we only got 5 minutes and I got 30 more minutes of material. That we're always going to be in danger of government declaring us terrorists or taking away our rights. That's why it's a representative form of government. If we don't like the system and the way that they're implementing it, then we need to throw them out. I haven't seen yet the prosecution of the war on terror done in a way that abuses our constitutional rights. I've heard the fears and I've heard the concerns, and I share the concerns, and I'm watching that as well. I need to look at the language of what you're talking about now, but so far I have not seen it abused to the point, or abused, used in a way that abuses the Constitution. I haven't seen that. I haven't seen a single case that does that. You're going to have to draw the line somewhere, and we may disagree on where that line needs to be. So far, I think the Bush administration did an extremely good job of balancing that. And frankly, I think the Obama administration has done a good job of balancing that so far, except that I think they've gone too far to protect the terrorists and not the system. I think when we get to the point that we're not willing to waterboard, which frankly, I was waterboarded in eighth grade. We called it a swirly. So I know I'm making light of something that's not a light situation, but it's actually, I mean, it's ridiculous when we get to the point that President Obama apologizes to the terrorists because we take an admitted terrorist, we put a neck brace on them so that we can slam them up against a false wall. It's a wall that's going to give way so the terrorist isn't hurt. And before we do it, we put a neck brace on them to make sure that they're not hurt. My sister in high school treated me worse than this. I mean, if we really want answers from these terrorists, let me send my sister in. We will get more answers than what we're getting from this judge. So my point is, we've gone soft on the enemy. And it's just almost silly. So there needs to be a balance in protecting our constitutional rights, but prosecuting a war on terror and being willing to fight on a level that we need to be willing to fight on. And I think they're now siding too much on protecting the terrorists instead of protecting our constitutional rights. But at the same time, I totally understand where you're coming from. I recognize the concerns. I don't want us to become a totalitarian state either. All I'm saying is that up to this point, I think the balance has been pretty darn good. I haven't seen us go over the edge. And I'll be right there with you fighting against it if they do go over the edge. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I know. I keep hearing this, but I haven't seen it in the law. I want to see it. I want to see the actual language in the law. My concern is in hearing all this is that someone is taking two different laws and putting them together. The indefinite detainment, I am all for suspected terrorists that are not United States citizens. I am not for that if you are a United States citizen and would be all for your right to habeas corpus and be able to get in front of a judge. And so if what you're saying is accurate and that's the way it is in the law and that's what's going to be implemented, then I will be with you at the rally to campaign against it. But I just haven't read the law. So I'm speaking out of ignorance and all I've seen is a newsletter somebody handed me at the lunch break. And my experience is that these things often get distorted and overblown. And so I just want to make sure before I take a position on it that I'm reading the actual law. So, in other words, let's punt on this one. Because the game starts in 30 minutes. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Remind me again. Because I got to, what to do? Obviously vote. Look, go through the whole Constitution looking for where your job is. First place we see it, right there on page one, in article one, the very first word that invokes a responsibility on your part, chosen. The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people. So the first time we have a job to do is in the very second paragraph of the Constitution. Obviously, we got to vote. I know you're doing that. What I would encourage you to do is spread your influence and multiply your impact on the process. Don't just vote in November. Make sure you're voting in the primary where you have 10 times the influence of who's going to have who everybody else is going to choose from in November. Noah Webster tells us how to vote. When you become entitled to exercise the right of voting for public officers, let it be impressed on your mind that God commands for you to choose for your rulers just men who will rule in the fear of God. The preservation of our government depends on the faithful discharge of this duty. If the citizens neglect their duty and place unprincipled men in office, the government will soon be corrupted. Laws will be made not for the public good so much as for selfish or local purposes. Bridge to nowhere. Corrupt or incompetent men will be appointed to execute the laws. The public revenues will be squandered on unworthy men and the rights of the citizens will be violated or disregarded. If our government fails to secure public prosperity and happiness, it must be because the citizens neglect the divine commands and elect bad men to make and administer the laws. Buck stops with us. We've got to choose wisely. We got to vote wisely. We know when the righteous rule, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, the people groan. All of these things we're concerned about. It all comes back to who are we putting in office. We don't like the results we're getting. Bad results are the result of bad policy. Where does bad policy come from? It comes from that group I used to call foolish politicians. My wife said that's not very nice, so we changed it. It now it says ill-advised officials. So we get bad policy from ill-advised officials, but where do we get these ill-advised officials? We the people, choice of the people. So here's my challenge to you. Don't just show up in November and make a choice. Okay? We can all complain about the choices in November, can't we? I mean, it's easy to show up at a party or a reception, look at those options out on the, you know, all the different desserts and say, I don't like that flavor. I don't like, why didn't they do that? It's a lot harder to show up early, get in the kitchen, and be part of mixing up the ingredients that will produce the options for everybody else when they show up at the party. So that's what I'm asking you to do. Get in the kitchen. Get involved in the mixing bowl of our system of government. There are three ingredients that you can influence in the mixing bowl. Number one is the knowledge of the people. That's what we're doing here. We're learning the principles. We're learning the plumb line so we can measure the candidates by that. Secondly, we need to be involved in the pool of candidates, recruiting good candidates, encouraging people to run that we know are men and women of integrity that have led in business or from the pulpit or in education or whatever it might be, and get them to run. We need a better pool of candidates. And then the actions of the citizens, being engaged in the process, making the phone calls, knocking on the doors, getting engaged in a way that will influence and multiply my vote to be hundreds of votes by influencing the other people out there. That's the mixing bowl. If you'll get engaged and you'll work the system works. From that mixing bowl, we'll get a better choice of the people. Then we get the statesmen and the patriots and not the politicians. That gives us good policy. Then we get good results. We all know what we want in terms of results. More freedom and choice. Lower taxes. Smart. I mean, all those things. We know what we want. The trick is getting there, and it's all coming back to that mixing bowl and being a part of that. Not only voting, you talk about Article 3 and judges. You say, Rick, how can I make a difference on federal judges? Support the Alliance Defense Fund. Support ACLU. Support Pacific Justice Institute. Pay attention to your state judges. Do y'all have elections for your state judges, or are they appointed here in Oregon? You might know. About half the states are appointed, half the states are elected. If it's elected, keep it that way. Don't let George Soros and his money come in. They're working hard to get away from elected judges at the state level. If it's not elected judges, work hard to get it changed to where you can elect your judges. That's the farm team, so we want the state judges to be good as well. Educate people on the fact that we're a republic, not a democracy. A republic. Make that one of your pet peeves that you educate people on. Tune into Wall Builders Live so we can equip you and give you the ammunition to make a difference. Get young people coming to Patriot Academy. This is where we're working on the next generation. For 1 week, I bring in young people from across the nation to spend a week with me at the state capitol in Austin, Texas. They live the life of a legislator for a week, all right? They're on the real House floor, debating in the real chamber, at the real microphone. They're in committee till late into the night, passing bills, debating issues, learning a founding father's philosophy of government, learning the conservative principles and how to apply that to pieces of legislation, and learning how to win. It's not enough to be right. We have to win. We got to have the right strategy. We got to learn how to articulate the message. I mean, if this presidential primary hasn't shown us that it's not enough to have the right positions or be able to articulate the message, you've got to be able to do both. You got to have the convictions, have the positions, and be able to sell it to the American people and get the job done. That's what Patriot Academy is all about. And I'm telling you, if you need encouragement, you come sit in the Texas Capitol Gallery the first week of August and you listen to these young people. Passionate, articulate, men and women of Issachar. They get it. They understand the times and they know what to do. I'm telling you, God's raising up a generation that's going to fix everything we messed up. Patriot Academy. Get a brochure out there. Young people that are here, come spend a week with me. We want you to be a part of this. Sponsor a student. If you're sitting in the room and you say, I want to be a part of that, help the kids actually raise their tuition. So we don't want parents writing a check. They're like candidates. They go out and raise their tuition, and now they're building a base of support for whatever they end up doing. You don't have to want to be a politician. You just got to want to be a good citizen and learn how to influence what's going on out there. Get involved in the amendments. Watch the treaties. Live out the Bill of Rights. Live those freedoms. Don't just talk about freedom of religion. Live out your faith. Don't just talk about freedom of the press. Be the press. Start a local newspaper. Start a blog. Be part of a kind of being a Paul Revere that's spreading the word out there and influencing the people that God's put into your life. Assemble every chance you get. Petition the government. Be a part of it. Take the advice of this guy right here, the Reverend Matthias Burnett. In 1802, he said this. To God and posterity, you're accountable for your rights and your rulers. Let not your children have reason to curse you for giving up those rights and prostrating those institutions which your fathers delivered to you. Man, I don't want my grandkids cursing me someday because I didn't do my job. I didn't preserve freedom on my watch, and now they don't get to live in the same freedom that I enjoyed. Let's all do our part. Start spreading this out. Open up your living room to be a place of learning for the people that you have the opportunity to influence. Get the class, this whole thing on DVD, and share it with other people in your living room. We're going to do webinars. We're going to start doing this class online. So you've got friends all over the country that can sign up on a Monday night and spend 3 hours going through the abbreviated version of this class with us from their desk or their computer, wherever they are. I'm going to leave you with this guy right here because I don't know if we're going to win a lot of these battles this year or next year or 5 years from now or 10 years from now. I have no idea. Only God knows how this thing is going to turn out. And so the only way I know to have peace in this process, to fight these battles, but be able to put my head on the pillow at night in peace, is to recognize that God's sovereign. And so I've adopted what this guy right here said when he was fighting a two-decade battle that he didn't get to win. John Quincy Adams was president, but then he went home and ran for Congress. Only guy in history to do that. Can you imagine being president and then going and being one of today 535 members of Congress in the House and the Senate both? He does it for one reason. He wants to end slavery. So he ends up in Congress, in a pro-slavery Congress, beating his head against the wall, trying to end slavery. He comes in week after week, month after month, trying to end slavery with no accomplishments. For 13 years, the man fought. 13 years, no results. Now, how long have we been in this battle to end Obamacare? 2.5 years? 3 years, I guess? Right? I mean, I used to give up if I couldn't get results in 1 year. I thought, 1 year, that's a long time to be dedicated to. 13 years the man fought with zero results. A reporter finally comes to him and says, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? He said, duty is ours. Results are God's. Now, think about that. 13 years I fought with zero results, yet he has peace because he knows I'm just supposed to do my duty, just like that parable we were talking about. God's going to take care of the results. Do you get to see an end to slavery? No. 4 years later, after that reporter asked him that question, he dies in Congress, right there on the floor of Congress. He rolls over, ends up dying in the speaker's room, actually, 3 days later. But there in Congress, he dies after 17 years of fighting, never got to see the fruit of his labor. But for 1 2-year term, he served with a kid that he mentored. In fact, it became so, you can imagine if the president's in Congress, if Ronald Reagan was in Congress, all the Republican freshmen would want to get to know him, right? If Bill Clinton's in Congress, all the Democrat freshmen, all the freshmen tried to get to know John Quincy Adams. One kid got really close to him. In fact, this kid was so close to John Quincy Adams, he was actually a pallbearer at John Quincy Adams' funeral. So he became very close to him. Adams taught him everything he could. Kid goes home to run for re-election after Adams dies. He doesn't get re-elected. In fact, he keeps running for offices, keeps losing. Keeps run for election or something, loses. Run for statewide election, loses. This kid actually finally wins an election 15 years later, and he becomes president of the United States. Abraham Lincoln took John Quincy Adams' plan that John Quincy Adams had mentored him in for 2 years, and 15 years later implements it and ends slavery. We have no idea who we might be passing the torch to that's going to accomplish what God's put on our hearts today. I'd love to see abortion end in my lifetime. May or may not happen. I'd love to see a lot of things happen. I'd love to see this Constitution once again be followed the way the founders intended. What I do know is God's raising up a generation of young people. If we can keep that torch lit, if we can light it in the hearts and the minds of this next generation, I believe, Lord willing, God's going to preserve this nation for the next generation. I really appreciate you guys spending your time with me today. Be glad to visit with you as long as you want to. Outside in the lobby. God bless you. Pastor, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Rick. Sure enjoyed that. Very informative. I want to thank each one of you for coming, participating. If you have an opportunity, he's going to be speaking twice tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock and then 11 o'clock, two different subjects. If you have your own church, be there. God bless you. Have a nice evening.